Welcome to Cal State University, Domingo Hills. We're coming live to you on cable channel LA36 and worldwide on the internet. I'm your presenter, Sadullah Khan, and we are doing the SBS 318 program on Islamic culture and civilization. Today we are doing the 13th of a 13-part session, and it'll be the last one. I hope you have benefited from the previous ones. And let's wrap up today's one, and I hope it'll be as interesting and well-received as the first 12 have been. And we thank you for all your comments and contributions and questions and for your participation thus far. And we encourage you today to call in, as you've done in the past, to share some of your ideas and also to make an input, whether by email or by telephone, whichever way you wish to contact us, and we'll have the numbers on a bit later on. Today in session 13, we will be dealing with civilizational identity. And I think it's important for us to understand that when dealing with a culture and civilization, we need to understand that we're dealing with people with social interaction. And let me begin from the outset by making reference to an extract, an article written on the globalization of Islam, which was printed in the Oxford History of Islam. And I quote here Professor Yvonne Yazbek Haddad. She is a professor of history of Islam and of Christian-Muslim relations at Georgetown University here in America. And she is quoted in the Globalization of Islam, the article which she wrote, Professor Yvonne Haddad, in this book, Oxford History of Islam, says, "The history of Islam in the contemporary world, as throughout much of history, continues to be one of dynamic change. Muslim societies have experienced the effects of rapid change, and with it, the challenges in religious, political, and economic development. Muslims continue to grapple with the relationship of the present and the future to the past. Like believers in their sister traditions, Judaism and Christianity, the critical question is the relationship of faith and tradition to change in a rapidly changing and pluralistic society. As Dr. Fazlur Rahman, a distinguished Muslim scholar, observed in his book Islam and Modernity, Muslims need some first-class minds who can interpret the old in terms of the new as regards substance and turn the new into the service of the old as regards ideals." Professor Yvonne Haddad, as I mentioned, I'm quoting her in an article compiled by Professor John Esposito in the Oxford History of Islam, which is the work that we have here. She goes on to say, "Since the early 1970s, Western Europeans and North Americans have become increasingly concerned about an apparent change in the nature and patterns of human migration. For some, this change threatens to alter the ethnic and religious composition of their nation-states, their democratic and capitalist traditions, and their liberal social values. The immigration and settlement of Muslims from more than 70 nations to the West have been of some concern. For those in the West who believe in the purity of race, civilization, and culture, or in a supersessionist Judeo-Christian worldview, this movement of Muslims is a menacing threat to what they believe to be a homogeneous Western society. For others, it increasingly represents a significant demographic shift that posits a major cultural challenge, the precise consequences of which are unpredictable, unforeseen, because they require a variety of adjustments by both the host countries and the new immigrants. Until recently," writes Professor Yvonne Haddad, "many Europeans and North Americans tended to identify Islam with Arabs. More knowledgeable scholars added parts of Asia and Africa to the abode of Islam. Other scholars were reluctant to admit that not only is Islam a universal religion with adherents throughout the globe, but that it has increasingly become part and parcel of the West. Finally, will the juggernaut of assimilation that has reshaped Europe and North America in a long process of secularization, modernization, and liberalization be able to reshape the Muslims to the extent that they can dissolve into the Western mix, abandoning their distinctive identities, practices, and cultures? Or will they opt for integration, holding on to their distinctive identities and preferences, at the same time participating in the political and social life of their adopted countries, demanding equal rights and proportional representation as a distinct group? The questions are not only concerned with what would happen to be Muslim when they choose between assimilation, integration, or separation, but more important, the questions are also concerned with the manner in which Muslims' integration, assimilation, or separation would affect the very fabric of Western society. What kind of society will Europe and America become as a consequence of the introduction of the new mix of peoples and cultures who affirm a vibrant religion, the religion of Islam? This is an article, extract of an article written by Professor Yvonne Haddad in an article titled The Globalization of Islam. And she is a professor of history of Islam and of Christian-Muslim relations at Georgetown University. We now take a snippet at an interview conducted by ABC on Nightline with Professor John Esposito. And this interview was conducted immediately after the Oklahoma bombing. But nonetheless, some of the points that Professor Esposito brings up and some of the concerns and questions that he raises are very significant for us to reflect upon. Let's go and have a look at the ABC snippet, the interview with Professor John Esposito, also of Georgetown University.
Well, I think that basically we came into the situation with a sense of ignorance about Islam and the Muslim world in the 70s because we weren't aware of the region. We didn't know or feel there were that many Muslims among us, whereas being basically Judeo-Christian in background, we were much more concerned with that part of the world, and then became traumatized by the Iranian Revolution and the image of Americans held hostage, the slaying of Anwar Sadat. And against the background of ignorance, we generalized from one or two incidents about a vast religion and group of people in a way that we don't do with regard to, let's say, Judaism or Christianity.
Before we go back and listen to some of the people from Cedar Rapids, some of the Muslim residents of Cedar Rapids tell us a little about themselves and about their faith, I wonder if you would spell out for us what the great similarities are between Judaism and Christianity and the Muslim faith, and also where the differences lie.
Well, I think that there are remarkable similarities. That is, Muslims, like Jews and Christians, worship the one God. They recognize a line of prophets from Adam and Abraham to Moses and Jesus. They believe that revelation came to Moses, to Jesus, and then one final time to the prophet Muhammad. They believe in ethical responsibility and accountability, and that you'll be judged on that and either have eternal reward in heaven or eternal punishment in hell. So there are all three are very much children of Abraham, see themselves as descendants from Abraham, and people of the book, have a scripture.
Do Muslims believe that someday there will be a Messiah, or do they regard Muhammad as being the Messiah?
Muhammad is the final prophet, and I think that that's the best way to see it. He's one of a long line of prophets, but he is the final prophet who has brought the final revelation in the Holy Quran.
And does that ultimately lead to an apocalypse, or ultimately lead to a day of judgment? What lies at the end of the road for a Muslim?
It's the day of judgment. It's very similar in many ways to the belief of many Jews and Christians that in the end there will be a day of judgment when all will come before God and will receive, as I said, eternal reward or punishment.
Let me bring you back just for one moment to the events of Oklahoma City. Do you think the national embarrassment at having jumped to the wrong conclusion here is sufficient that it may actually lead not only to a little more tolerance but a little more understanding?
I hope so. I mean, one would like to think that having jumped the gun and made a mistake that will happen, but I don't know. I find that the sort of forces of the stereotyping of the past are still very much in place. I mean, for example, the other day I saw a leading journalist interviewed after the incident, and the best that he could do is blame television. But he basically said it was a logical conclusion. In fact, these people could still be behind the right-wing American militias, and if that mentality is out there, that makes me a bit nervous.
Mr. Esposito, thanks very much.
Professor Esposito there responding to questions from Ted Koppel in the ABC Nightline program some time ago. But nonetheless, some of the questions that he raised in response to some of the attitudes are still significant for us to reflect upon and to engage. In the introduction to a remarkable work by Professor Jane Smith, Islam in America, a recent work. She's Professor of Islamic Studies at the Hartford Seminary in Connecticut. Professor Jane Smith, Islam in America, she writes, and I think it's appropriate for us to reflect on what Professor Smith says. She said it has become commonplace to note that in the West in general, and in the U.S. in particular, Muslims can no longer be thought of as over there. I repeat, it has become commonplace to note that in the West in general, and in the United States in particular, Muslims no longer can be thought of as over there. Increasingly, they are a visible and vocal part of the fabric of Western society. Still, only recently have many Americans begun to grasp that Islam alongside with Christianity and Judaism as itself a Western religion. Most scholarly as well as popular writings continue to slip easily into the dichotomy of Islam and the West, or Islam or the West, or Islam against the West. But information about Islam and Muslims is increasingly available through the media, and it's difficult not to notice the presence of Muslims in American cities and towns. Most Americans, however, remain only vaguely aware of the size and significance of the Muslim community in America, and know little, if anything, about the religion itself. Before an introductory talk that I gave on Muslim faith and practice recently, a woman asked me, "Where is Islam?" supposing it to be a country. For the most part, Americans have little concept that approximately as many Muslims as Jews live in America, and Muslims outnumber many of the mainline Protestant sects. Today, the American Muslim community is comprised of people drawn from a wide-ranging ethnic and professional mix. Whether they are immigrants, indigenous Americans, or converts, all are united in the unique theistic experience that is Islam. Whether they are physicians, lawyers, entrepreneurs, professors, cooks, or factory workers, all of them are making a contribution to America's future. These observations from an address given at the 34th Annual Convention of ISNA, which is the largest Islamic organization in America, and it is the acronym for Islamic Society of North America, at one of the annual conventions, it suggests both that the heterogeneity of the American Muslim community and the concern of many of its members and leaders that Islam be recognized as a legitimate and contributing sector of American society. What is this religion whose presence in the U.S. is so visible and so permanent that many Muslims are asking for America to be called a Judeo-Christian Muslim country? Is it simply a foreign religion somehow transplanted into Western soil, or is it emerging as a genuinely American phenomenon? Professor Jane Smith, in this wonderful work, Islam in America, goes on to say, "The faith of Islam arose in 7th century Arabia, when, as Muslims believe, God chose a religious visionary named Muhammad to be the last prophet of the monotheistic religions." Professor Smith goes on to say, It spread rapidly throughout the greater Middle East, North Africa, and Southern Europe, and within a century was a vital force in much of the known world. For most of the history, Muslims have been creative contributors to the development of science, art, literature, philosophy, technology, and culture. Major Muslim empires ruled over vast areas of the world until the beginning of the 20th century. Today, there are more than 1 billion Muslims across the globe, found in virtually every country, and Islam is considered one of the 5 great world religions. Muslims understand the Quran, the holy book of Islam, to be the verbatim revelation of God to Muhammad, and it is now available in translation, as some Muslims would say, interpretation, in most of the world's languages. The growth of Islam during the early centuries of its existence was a difficult phenomenon for Western Christianity to comprehend, and misunderstanding, prejudice, fear, and in some cases hatred have characterized much of the history of an encounter between the two faiths. This legacy, along with current fears and concern about supposed Islamic extremism, forms part of the context in which to understand the experience of Muslims in what has been mainly a Christian America. Professor Jane Smith, in this book, Islam in America, goes on to say, though Islam is an Abrahamic faith alongside Judaism and Christianity, argues a Muslim historian, it is usually seen as threatening both mum and apple pie, as well as threatening Judeo-Christian values. This sentiment is increasingly balanced in the US, however, by efforts on the part of non-Muslim Americans working with Muslims to achieve a fair representation of Islam. Many questions face the community as it looks to the immediate future. How will Islam and thus America itself change as second, third, and fourth generation of immigrants become more distant from their places of origin? Non-Muslim Americans can no longer talk about Islam as foreign or even as Eastern religion. Islam has become part of America, and Muslims a growing and vital segment of its population. How will this affect both external and internal perceptions of Islam and Muslims? Will the majority of Muslims identify themselves as Americans who happen to be Muslim, or as Muslims who happen to live in America? And what differences will such identification make in their public and private lives? Will Islam in America achieve its currently stated goals of becoming a significant political force? Is it likely that American resentment and prejudice against Islam will subside as the result of greater contact with Muslims and better understanding of their faith and practice? Who will provide the authoritative voices for American Muslims as they increasingly are able to choose where to go for direction? We made reference early on to Professor John Esposito from Georgetown University. In an article titled Political Islam in the West, Political Islam in the West, Professor Esposito raised the issue of the Islamic threat, or the issue of a clash of civilizations, which we touched upon somewhat last week, and I wish somewhat to elaborate upon this week. Because in order to develop an identity and to understand one another, to be able to identify who we are and what we are, it's important to understand what are the frames of references. In the article Political Islam and the West by Professor John Esposito, under the section Islamic Threat or Clash of Civilizations, Professor Esposito, whom we saw early on responding to Ted Koppel in the ABC Nightline interview, Professor Esposito writes, and I quote, in recent years, some observers have spoken of a clash of civilizations between Islam and the modern secular or the Judeo-Christian democratic values and culture, or between Islamic civilization and the West. Early underestimation of religion as a source of identity as well as a political force, along with its failure as a predictive paradigm, has led to its overestimation today. New recognition of religious significance in international affairs has reinforced an exaggerated belief in the impending clash of civilizations. The most provocative articulation of this position was advanced by Samuel Huntington, who declared that in the post-Cold War period, the clash of civilizations will dominate global politics. We are quoting Professor Esposito, and there we have a picture of him. Professor Esposito, in his article, Political Islam in the West, responding to that issue, he writes here, the fault lines between civilizations will be the battle lines of the future, according to Huntington. The next world war, if there is one, will be a war between civilizations. Professor Esposito quotes Huntington as saying in Huntington's article, which he wrote in 1993, which was called A Clash of Civilizations, and eventually became a full-scale book in 1996. Huntington's position emphasizes religion and cultural differences over similarities and equates political, economic, and cultural differences with confrontation. Professor Huntington, as we see there, Professor Huntington, by the way, was a former director of security planning for the National Security Council, and he remains an influential member of the small circle that makes American strategic decisions from his current position as a director of the John M. Olin Institute for Strategic Studies and the chairman of the Harvard Academy for International and Area Studies, Professor Huntington, who wrote that article on Clash of Civilizations. So Esposito, responding to that article, says that Huntington's position emphasizes religious and cultural differences over similarities and equates political, economic, and cultural differences with confrontation. Areas of cooperation and the fact that most countries are primarily, although not solely, driven by national and regional interests are overlooked in Huntington's analysis. The creation of an imagined monolithic Islam has resulted in a religious reductionism that views political conflicts in Azerbaijan, Bosnia, Chechnya, Indonesia, Kosovo, Lebanon, Nigeria, and Sudan as religious conflicts. Although communities in these areas may be broadly identified in religious or confessional terms like Catholic and Protestant communities in Northern Ireland or Hindu, Tamil, and Buddhist communities in Sri Lanka, local disputes and civil wars have more to do with political, ethnic, and socio-economic issues than with religion, writes Professor Esposito. Professor Esposito goes on to say in this article, Political Islam in the West, the challenge in an increasingly interdependent world is recognition of both competing and common interests. American policy towards Japan or Saudi Arabia is not based on shared culture or shared religion or shared civilization, but on national or group interests. Cooperation can result from common religious and ethnic backgrounds. However, it often is derived from common national and strategic interests. Although a clash of civilizations might be used to justify aggression, future conflicts will be due less to a clash of civilizations and more to a clash of interests. Secular fundamentalism is implicit in many analyses of political Islam, an interpretation that regards mixing religion and politics as abnormal, irrational, dangerous, and extremist. Those who subscribe to this view are known as fundamentalists or religious fanatics. Thus, when secular Westerners encounter Muslims who speak of Islam as a comprehensive way of life, they dub them retrogressive and resistant to change. Assuming that mixing religion and politics inevitably leads to extremism has contributed to the attitude that all Islamic movements are extremist and incompatible with democracy. Failure to differentiate between Islamic movements is misleading. Few equate actions by Jewish or Christian extremists with Judaism and Christianity as a whole. Similarly, the United States does not object officially to mixing religion and politics in Eastern Europe, Israel, or Latin America. Comparable liberality is absent when dealing with Islam, writes Professor Esposito in this article, Political Islam in the West. Many nations identify political Islam as a threat to their domestic and international security concerns. Bombings and murder in the Middle East, Europe, and North America bolster this argument. However, questions remain. Should social problems be blamed on fundamentalist fanatics? Are the activities of a radical minority being used as a convenient excuse for the failures of local governments to build equitable societies? Does this perceived threat support authoritarian military regimes whose non-elected rulers want first and foremost to perpetuate their own power? Analysis and strategic planning require movement beyond an imagined monolithic political Islam. Differences in state Islam, as seen in Iran, Libya, Morocco, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Sudan, are also found in the varieties among Islamic movements. They range from moderates or pragmatists who work within the system to radical extremists who seek to overthrow regimes and to impose their own brand of Islam. So we find Professor Esposito in this article reminding us about the variety that Islam, nor are Muslims a monolithic group. Talking about the clash of civilizations and the response to that, Dr. Fred Halliday, wrote a response, Islam and the Myth of Confrontation. And he raises some questions. One of the points that Professor or Dr. Fred Halliday raises in this book, Islam and the Myth of Confrontation, he says, Muslims themselves feel under siege in Kashmir, Bosnia, Chechnya, and academic contributions to Muslim-Western relations have often not helped. Samuel Huntington's now infamous article in Foreign Affairs, The Clash of Civilizations, has been seen by some as the new clarion call for Christendom to engage in a new, culturally sanctioned crusade against Islam. But what of the confrontation? It seems to live as much in myth as reality. From misrepresentation about history, public ignorance, and a deep fear of the unknown combined to provide ample rhetoric for the would-be midwives of the new Cold War. I repeat, when asked, what of the confrontation? He says, it seems to live as much in myth as reality. For misrepresentation about history, public ignorance, and a deep fear of the unknown combined to provide ample rhetoric for the would-be midwives of a new Cold War, this time between Muslim world and the West. Now, we mentioned about Samuel Huntington's article, Clash of Civilizations, which of course we found it appeared in the Foreign Affairs Journal in 1993. The American Journal of Foreign Affairs, and eventually became a full-length book in 1996. Now, we need to realize that some of the assertions or some of the points that were raised by Professor Huntington and almost taken for granted, it's almost becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy now with this war on the excess of evil. So, looking very briefly at some of the major points that Professor Huntington made and then the response to by some scholars regarding that, Huntington's article suggests that the current struggle between civilizations or struggles in the world are struggles between civilizations and is based on the fact that different cultures define people, border, and countries. It's cultures that define borders, people, and countries. And the most severe struggle, Huntington believed, is the one that is taking place and will continue, he believes, to take place between the Western civilization on the one hand and the Islamic and the Confucian or Chinese civilizations on the other. He also suggests that the West has to first ally itself or at least neutralize other civilizations in order to defeat the Islamic and Chinese civilizations. And after defeating the Muslims and the Chinese, the West can then contain the remaining civilizations and thus remain dominant. He has also emphasized the multiplicity of civilizations, which sometimes borders virtually on some degree of racism almost. But nonetheless, Huntington defined culture as a source of difference among civilizations, noting that different civilizations share material knowledge and the science, but differ in the understanding of and manner of nurturing the human soul, the purview of culture. And he has divided the world into basically 8 different civilizations, of which the Western civilization, Japanese civilization, the Hindu or Indian civilizations, the Slavic or Orthodox civilization, the Latin American civilization, the African civilization, the Confucian or Chinese civilization, and the Islamic civilization. And the differences in the civilizational components of the nations and people living in different civilizations, such as language, history, culture, tradition, custom, and most importantly, religion, means that there is a fundamental difference of opinion regarding important relationships that define how people see their roles in society and the world at large. Relationships such as that between man and God, or the individual and the group, or the citizen and the country, for example. When we look at Huntington and his analysis, and of course his influence, what is bothersome is that Huntington seems to advise American policymakers to work towards internally uniting the Western civilization, which basically means the white world or the European world. Much of the former colonial masters with America join up as the Western civilization, and strengthening its overall military strength. He also suggests that the West should try to absorb Eastern Europe and Latin America so as to increase the strength of Western civilization. This united and reinvigorated Western civilization, according to Huntington, would then be able to at least check or keep the Sino-Islamic or Chinese and Islamic or the Confucian Islamic civilization weakened or under check somewhat. Now, some of the other responses to what Huntington had said. Last week we touched upon some of them, but due to time constraints, we were not able to do so. And in trying to define our civilizational identity, that Muslims or Islam is as much part of any part of the world, whether Eastern or Western, as Christianity or Judaism. And the fact that Islam is so widespread, and of course over 50 million in larger Europe, in Western Europe alone over 25 million Muslims, and in America between 6 to 9 million Muslims, for example, and Islam the second largest religion in America, the second largest religion in Europe, and the fastest religion, growing religion both in America and in Europe, the reality of seeing the Muslims as the other, or rather this, the fallacy of seeing Muslims as the other, is part of a negative stereotyped perception of Muslims and of Islam. And therefore, when responding to this issue of this civilizational fault lines, as if there's an imminent clash of civilizations, that Muslims belong to a particular civilization, will also somehow affect how the Muslim presence in the West, because it will assume that Muslims who are in the West are part of another civilization, though they are as Western as any American or any European, or as African and as any other African, or Eastern as any other Easterner. And this is a very dangerous ground, because Muslims are almost singled out as being part of the other wherever they are in the West, if Huntington's theory is taken at face value. Dr. Kishore Mahbubani, who is Deputy Secretary of Foreign Affairs and Dean of the Civil Service College in Singapore, who also served Singapore's permanent representative to the United Nations in 1984 to 1989, he responds to what Professor Huntington says. Dr. Mahbubani from Singapore says, "The confidence that the West would remain a dominant force in the 21st century, as it has for the past four or five centuries, is giving way to a sense of foreboding that forces like the emergence of fundamentalist Islam, the rise of East Asia, and the collapse of Russia and Eastern Europe could pose real threats to the West. A siege mentality is developing. Within these troubled walls, Samuel Huntington's essay, The Clash of Civilizations, is bound to resonate it. It will therefore come as a great surprise to many Westerners to learn that the rest of the world fears the West even more than the West fears it. I repeat. It will therefore come as a great surprise to many Westerners to learn that the rest of the world fears the West even more than the West fears it, especially the threat posed by a wounded West." Dr. Mahbubani goes on to say, from the he's the Dean of the Civil Service College in Singapore, says, "The key purpose of Huntington's essay seems to sensitize Western audiences to the perceptions of the rest of the world and the West. Huntington discusses the challenge posed by Islamic and Confucian civilizations, Islamic and Chinese civilizations. Since the bombing of the World Trade Centers, Americans have begun to absorb European paranoia about Islam, perceived as a force of darkness hovering over a virtuous Christian civilization. It is ironic, writes Dr. Mahbubani, that the West should increasingly fear Islam when daily the Muslims are reminded of their own weakness. Islam has bloody borders, Huntington says. But in all the conflicts between the Muslim and pro-Western forces, the Muslims are losing, and losing badly, whether the Azeris, the Palestinians, the Iraqis, the Iranians, the Bosnians, Muslims. With so much disunity, the Islamic world is not about to coalesce into a single force. Oddly, for all this paranoia, the West seems to be almost deliberately pursuing a cause designed to aggravate the Islamic world. The West protests the reversal of democracy in Myanmar, Peru, or Nigeria, but not in Algeria, where a Muslim Islamic party came to power by means of democratic elections. These double standards hurt. Bosnia has wreaked incalculable damage. The dramatic passivity of powerful European nations as genocide is committed on their doorsteps has torn away the thin veil of moral authority that the West had spun around itself as a legacy of its recent benign era. Western behavior towards China has been equally puzzling, writes Dr. Mahbubani. Few in the West are aware that the West is responsible for aggravating turbulence among the more than 2 billion people living in the Islamic and Chinese civilizations. Instead, conjuring up images of the two Asian hordes that Western minds fear most, two forces that invaded Europe, the Muslims and the Mongols, Huntington posits a Confucian-Islamic connection against the West. American arms sales to Saudi Arabia do not suggest a natural Christian-Islamic connection. Neither should Chinese arms sales to any Muslim country imply a Chinese-Islamic connection. Both are opportunistic moves based not on natural empathy or civilizational alliances. Dr. Mahbubani goes on to say, Huntington fails to ask one obvious question. If other civilizations have been around for centuries, why are they posing a challenge only now? Dr. Jean J. Kirkpatrick, Levy Professor of Government at Georgetown University and Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, writes, if civilization is defined by common objective elements such as language, history, religion, customs, and institutions, and subjectively by identification, and if it is the broadest collectivity with which persons intensify, intensely identify, why distinguish Latin America from Western civilization? I repeat the part. If civilization, this is Dr. Jean Kirkpatrick, Levy Professor of Government at Georgetown University and Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. If civilization is defined by common objectives, elements such as language, history, religion, customs, and institutions, and subjectively by identification, and if it is the broadest collectivity with which persons intensely identify, why then distinguish Latin America from Western civilization? Like North America, Latin America is a continent settled by Europeans who brought with them European languages and a European version of Judeo-Christian religion, law, literature, and gender roles. The Indian component in Latin American culture is more important in some countries, Mexico, Guatemala, Ecuador, and Peru, than in North America. But the African influence is more important in the U.S. than in all but a few Latin American countries, like for example, Belize, Brazil, and Cuba. Both North and South America are Western European with an admixture of other elements. And what is Russia if not Western? The East-West designation of the Cold War made sense in a European context. But in a global context, Slavic Orthodox people are Europeans who share a Western culture. Orthodox theology and liturgy, Leninism and Tolstoy are expressions of Western culture. It is also clear that over the centuries, differences between civilizations have led to the longest and most violent conflicts. At least in the 20th century, the most violent conflicts have occurred within civilizations. Stalin's purges, Pol Pot's genocide, the Nazi Holocaust, and World War II. It could be argued that the war between the US and Japan involved a clash of civilizations. But those differences had little role in that war. The Allied and the Axis sides included both Asian and European members. After the U.S. mobilized an international coalition against Iraq, Saddam Hussein, until then a leader of a revolutionary secular regime, he, Saddam Hussein, took to public prayer and appeals for solidarity to the Muslim world. Certain militant and anti-Western Muslim fundamentalist, Huntington reminds us, responded with the assertion that it was the war of the West against Islam, but a few believed it. More governments of predominantly Muslim societies and many Muslim communities rallied to support Kuwait, rather than to save Iraq. In Bosnia, the efforts of Radovan Karadzic and other Serbian extremists to paint themselves as bulwarks against Islam are no more persuasive, although the passivity of the European community, the US, NATO and the UN in the face of Serbia's brutal aggression against Bosnia has finally stimulated some tangible Islamic solidarity. But most governments of predominantly Muslim states have been reluctant to treat the Bosnian conflict as a religious war in itself. The Bosnian government itself has resisted any temptation to represent its problems as Islam versus the West. The fact that Serbian forces began the offensive against Croatia and Slovenia, which were both Christian, should settle the question of Serbian motives and goals, which are territorial aggrandizement and not a holy war. Indubitably, important social, cultural and political differences exist between Muslim and Judeo-Christian civilization. But the most important and explosive differences involving Muslims are found within the Muslim world, between persons, parties and governments who are reasonably moderate, non-expansionist and non-violent, and those who are anti-modern and anti-Western, extremely intolerant, expansionist and violent. You find all these traits, writes Dr. Jean Kirkpatrick, who is the senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. She goes on to say, the first target of Islamic fundamentalists is not another civilization, but very often their own governments. Please do not call them Muslim fundamentalists, a deeply religious friend of mine who's a Muslim said to me. They do not represent a more fundamental version of the Muslim religion. They are simply Muslims who are also violent political extremists. Dr. Gerard Peel, Chairman Emeritus of the Scientific American Incorporation, responding to the clash of civilizations, the modernizing imperative, tradition and change, the West is best, is the title of his article. He says, responding to Huntington's clash of civilizations, he says, we must be in terror of the civilizations conjured up by Samuel Huntington for the same reason that Niels Bohr admonished us to fear ghosts. We see them and we know they are not there. We see them and we know they are not there. We have another reason to be in terror of them. Without boundaries, interiors or exterior, continuity or coherent entity, any of the Huntington civilizations can be summoned in a moment to ratify whatever action the West and its remaining superpowers deem rightful. Alexander Evans, who I quoted somewhat last week, he responds to the clash of civilizations, and he wrote an article called The Politics of Anxiety. And he said, the best stories are often the simplest. And Samuel Huntington deploys a mixture of history and speculation to persuade us that civilizations are the only way to understand the contemporary world and to prepare for the future. Huntington hails from the realist and conservative stable of academics, yet manages to paint a picture that bears more than a passing resemblance to the determinism found in Marxism. Dr. Alexander Evans goes on to write, Islam does get considerable attention from Huntington. Huntington argues that a quasi-war has existed between Islam and the West since 1979, which is essentially inter-civilizational. Dr. Evans, in this article, Politics of Anxiety, then goes on to extract a quote from the book of Huntington, Clash of Civilizations, and he says, it is a quasi-war for three reasons. First of all, Islam has not been fighting all of the West. Second, it's a quasi-war because apart from the Gulf War of 1990-91, it has been fought with limited means. Terrorism on one side, and air power, covert action, and economic sanctions on the other. Third, it's a quasi-war because while the violence has been continuing, it has not been continuous. This assertion of conflict has been greeted by liberal horror by some reviewers who see in it a presumption of Orientalism, and given Huntington's thesis, almost an endorsement of such conflict. Not only is it happening, he seems to be arguing, not only is this clash happening, Huntington seems to be arguing, but he seems to be saying it is also natural. Many who seek to further the cause of inter-civilizational amity or relationship, while staying true to their own values, will see in this a deeply misleading vision. Another fault, writes Alexander Evans, is the most passionate identification of civilization with race throughout this book, the book Clash of Civilizations, which leaves untouched the possibility that a Briton of Indian origin or a Malaysian of Chinese descent might integrate with the state rather than always stand apart. This primordialist assumption that identity is primarily ethnic belittles many of the transformations and subtle variations that migration can produce. According to Huntington, ethnic conflict is the new local politics, just as civilizational conflict explains post-Cold War international relations. This, too, is perhaps misleading, for many contemporary conflicts, substrate, and low intensity have much to do with nationalism, economic disparities, banditry, or simple avarice as deep expressions of ethnic identity. His use of a barrage of examples is not sufficient proof in itself of his thesis. If you set out to describe the world in a certain way, evidence can be found for almost any paradigm. In an article by Dr. Tariq Masood, professor of sociology, politics and public policy, and is the director of the University Research Center for the Study of Ethnic and Citizenship at the University of Bristol. Professor Tariq Masood writes, "A clash of civilizations poses a danger of becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy at a time when we are all trying to make sense of an atrocity on such a large scale." Professor Masood writes, "The idea of Islam as separate from Judeo-Christian West is as false as it is influential." I repeat, "The idea of Islam as separate from Judeo-Christian West is as false as it is influential. Islam, with its faith in the revelations of Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad, peace be upon all of them, belongs to the same tradition as Christianity and Judaism." He goes on to write, "The Jews remember Muslim Spain as a golden age. Islam indeed then was a civilization, a superpower, and a genuine geopolitical rival to the West. The traditions borrowed and learned from each other, whether it was in relation to scholarship, philosophy, and scientific inquiry, or medicine, architecture, and technology. The classical learning from Athens and Rome, which was all but lost to Christendom, was preserved by the Arabs and came to Europe, like the institution of the university, from Muslims. That Europe came to define its civilizations as a renaissance of Greek and Rome and excised the Arab contribution to its foundations and well-being is an example of racist myth-making that has much relevance to today. Our shock and outrage at the murder of the innocents in America must not obscure a wider analysis and a wider sense of humanity," writes Professor Tariq Masood, who's, I mentioned, professor at the University of Bristol. "The murder and terror of civilians as policy does not begin with the acts of September 11th. If we attend to the news carefully, we will be reminded that they occur regularly in a number of places in the world. When some of these have been perpetrated or supported by the West, there emerges a deep sense of double standards. This is a source of grievance, hate, and terrorism is perhaps the most important lesson of September the 11th. Not the division of the world into rival civilizations, civilized and uncivilized, good and evil. This perception has to be addressed seriously if there is to be a dialogue across countries, across faith, and across cultures. And our foreign and security policies need to be reviewed in the light of the new understanding. Our security in the West, no less than that of any other part of the world, depends upon being tough on the causes of terrorism as well as on terror itself. It is true that what we need today is a greater understanding of the dispossessed and the powerless, especially when they seem culturally alien and mobilize around their group identities, then the diasporas in the West can also be a critical source of dialogue, understanding, and bridge building, facilitating communication and understanding in these fraught and potentially destabilizing times. Bridge building here doesn't imply, does not simply mean asking moderate Muslims to join and support the new project against terrorism. It is being asked why there are so few non-repressive governments in Muslim societies. Muslims must be at the forefront of asking these questions and helping to create constructive responses. Professor Mas'ud of Bristol University says, but we must also ask, where are the moderate Western governments when moderate Muslims call for international protection and justice in Bosnia, Palestine, Chechnya, and Kashmir, or for the easing of sanctions against Iraq? Professor Mas'ud says, U.S. policy relation to the Muslim world and many other parts of the world have been far from moderate. Now that a terrible tragedy has happened on Americans, the U.S. is asking moderate Muslims to get on the side. The fundamental question, however, is whether there is recognition by the U.S. of a need to radically review and change its attitude toward Muslims as well. Professor Edward Said, of course, a well-known writer, also responding to this issue of the clash of civilizations, writes, Islam in the West are simply inadequate. Of course, Professor Edward Said is professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University. He writes, Islam and the West are simply inadequate as banners to follow blindly. In fact, there's an article, it's called Islam and the West are Inadequate Banners. And I'm quoting central part of the article. Islam and the West are simply inadequate as banners to follow blindly. Some will run behind them, but for future generations to condemn themselves to a prolonged war and suffering without so much as a critical pause, without looking at interdependent histories of injustices and oppression, without trying for common emancipation and mutual enlightenment, seems far more willful than necessary. Demonization of the other is not a sufficient basis for any kind of decent politics. Certainly not now, when the roots of terror and injustice can be addressed. Professor Edward Said, responding to the clash of civilization, he wrote an article called The Clash of Ignorance, and I quote the conclusion of his article. He says, we are all swimming in those waters, Westerners and Muslims and others alike. And since the waters are part of the ocean of history, trying to plow or divide them with barriers is futile. These are tense times, says Professor Edward Said. But it is better to think these are tense times, but it is better to think in terms of powerful and powerless communities, the secular politics of reason and ignorance and universal principles of justice and injustice, than to wander off in search of vast abstractions that may give momentary satisfaction but little self-knowledge or informed analysis. The clash of civilization thesis is a gimmick like the war of the worlds. Better for reinforcing defensive self-pride. I repeat the last part. The clash of civilizations, this thesis is a gimmick like the war of the worlds. It is better, these are better for reinforcing defensive self-pride than for critical understanding of the bewildering interdependence of our time. We are part of one global community. Islam's contribution throughout history has indicated that from the outset, it was meant to be a global civilization. And from the outset, it intended and did incorporate all forms of people from all parts of the world from its very inception. Let's take a short look at a snippet, if we can, from Islam, the Empire of Faith, that deals and gives an indication of this idea. And this, by the way, the snippet is the last part of this fantastic program, Islam, Empire of Faith, that was on PBS. And I recommend you that tomorrow evening, which is the 8th of May, there is a program at 9 p.m., also on KCET, on the Muslims. And I think it will be very important for us to look at this, at these programs, which give a very fair and balanced view of what Islam is and Muslim contribution has been thus far. So let's take a look at the snippet, if possible, from Islam Empire of Faith, the last part of that program.
Become the best community ever raised up in mankind, the Quran assures all believers. Enjoining the right and forbidding the wrong and having faith in God. Islamic and Western civilization have the same roots. They're dawning in the Fertile Crescent. The monotheism of the Jews and Christians. The classical intellectual culture of the ancient Greeks. The two traditions are kindred spirits, alike, yet very different. Islam's legacy is intertwined with the West's, and to the billions of Muslims who make it the second largest religion in the world, it is a living legacy. An elemental part of the great human venture that is world civilization.
Yeah, that was the last part of the Islam Empire of Faith, an outstanding documentary on Islam. I wish to, in the last part of this first segment, of course we have three segments and we have two wonderful guests who are coming up. In the next hour we have an international guest from Egypt who will be with us, and thereafter a dear friend who started off the first program with me here and who will be here with me also in the last hour. But before we go into a break, let's deal for the next few minutes in this first segment. I want to look at an article which eventually also became a book by Professor John Esposito from Georgetown University, and it is called Islam, the Islamic Threat, Myth or Reality. Of course, Professor Esposito, we made quite a reference to him. He is the author of Islam, the Straight Path, a book which I highly recommend. In fact, for the understanding of this course and for those who do such courses on Islam, culture and civilization, there are two books that I recommend. This one is Islam, Straight Path by Professor Esposito, and of course the other one, Islam in America by Professor Jane Smith. These are two outstanding works, Islam in America by Jane Smith, and of course Islam, the Straight Path by Professor John Esposito. He is from Georgetown University, of course, and she's from the Hartford Seminary in Connecticut. Both are outstanding books for those who want to know more about Islam, specifically the history of Islam, the development of Islam, contemporary Islam, and also, of course, Islam in America. These are both outstanding works and that I've used for reference throughout these programs. Professor Esposito, in his work, The Islamic Threat, Myth or Reality. This is the title of a book. It was an article that eventually became a book. Islam, the Islamic Threat, Myth or Reality. And let's look at an extract from that. Professor Esposito asks, are Islam and the West on an inevitable collision course? Are Islamic fundamentalist medieval fanatics? Are Islam and democracy incompatible? Is Islamic fundamentalism a threat to stability in the Muslim world and to American interest in the region? These are critical questions for our times that come from a history of mutual distrust and mutual condemnation. Professor Esposito goes on to say, however diverse in reality the existence of Islam as a worldwide religion, and ideological force embracing one-fifth of the world's population, and its continued vitality and power in a Muslim world stretching from Africa to Southeast Asia will continue to raise the specter of an Islamic threat. In the 1990s, it is important that the vacuum created by the end of the Cold War not be filled by exaggerated fears of Islam as a resurgent evil empire at war with a new world order and as a challenge to global stability. I repeat, in the 1990s, he writes, and this book was written, of course, a few years ago, in the 1990s. He says, in the 1990s, it is important that the vacuum created by the end of the Cold War not be filled by exaggerated fears of Islam as a resurgent evil empire at war with the New World Order and as a challenge to global stability. No matter how and when the war ends, Islamic rage already threatens the stability of traditionally pro-Western regimes from Morocco to Jordan to Pakistan. He's quoting some people, some threatening writers who are saying these kind of things. Such belief that a clash of world views and world values and civilizations is leading to an impending confrontation between Islam and the West is very often reflected in headlines and articles with ominous titles like Still Fighting the Crusades, The New Crescent in Crisis. These are all titles in major magazines and journals. The Global Intifada. Rising Islam may overwhelm the West. The Roots of Muslim Rage. Clash of Civilizations. The Islamic War Against Modernity. And the Ark of Crisis. All these are titles that Professor Esposito quotes. While such phrases capture public attention and the popular imagination, they exaggerate and distort the nature of Islam, the political realities of the Muslim world, and its diverse relations with the West. They also reinforce an astonishing degree of ignorance and cultural stereotyping of Arabs and of Islam. For many in the West, it is axiomatic that Arabs are nomads or oil sheikhs, denizens of the deserts and harems, an emotional and combative and irrational people. Islam is often equated with holy war, with hatred, with fanaticism and violence, with intolerance and the oppression of women. As Western leaders attempt to forge the new world order, transnational Islam may increasingly come to be regarded as the new global monolithic enemy of the West. To some Americans, searching for a new enemy against whom to test our mettle and power after the death of communism, Islam seems to be the preferred antagonist. But to declare Islam an enemy of the United States is to declare a second Cold War that is unlikely to end in the same resounding victory as the first. Fear of the green menace, meaning Islam, may well replace that of the red menace of communism. Islam and Islamic movements constitute a religious and ideological alternative or challenge in some instances, a potential danger to Christianity and the West. However, distinguishing between a religious or ideological alternative or challenge and a direct political threat requires walking the fine line between myth and reality. I repeat, distinguishing between a religious or ideological alternative or challenge and a direct political threat requires walking the fine line between myth and reality. Between the unity of Islam and the diversity of its multiple and complex manifestations in the world today. Between the violent actions of the few and the legitimate aspirations of the many. Unfortunately, American policymakers, like the media, have too often proved surprisingly myopic, viewing the Muslim world and Islamic movements as a monolith and seeing them solely in terms of extremism and terrorism. While this is understandable in the light of events in Iran and Lebanon and the Gulf crisis in 1991, it fails to do justice to the complex realities of the Muslim world and can undermine relations between Islam and the West. As some dream of the creation of a new world order, and many millions in North Africa, the Middle East, Central Asia, Southern and Southeast Asia aspire to greater political liberalization and democratization, and continued vitality of Islam and Islamic movements, these need not be a threat, but a challenge. For many Muslims, Islamic revivalism is a social rather than a political movement whose goal is a more Islamically minded and oriented society, but not necessarily the creation of an Islamic state. For others, the establishment of an Islamic state requires the establishment of an Islamic order requires the creation of an Islamic state. In either case, Islam and most Islamic movements are not necessarily anti-Western, anti-American, or anti-democratic. While they are a challenge to the outdated assumptions of the established order and to the autocratic regimes, they do not necessarily threaten American interest. Our challenge is to better understand the history and the realities of the Muslim world. Recognizing the diversity and many facets of Islam counters our image of a unified Islamic threat. It lessens the risk of creating self-fulfilling prophecies about the battle of the West against Islam or against radical Islam. Guided by our stated ideals and goals of freedom and self-determination, the West has an ideal vantage point for appreciating the aspiration of many in the Muslim world as they seek to define new paths for the future. Let's play out with a song, One by U2. The idea that the world is actually one. We are part of one globe, one world. Before we go to a break, I started off the first program by reading a short quote. There's a book on Islam, A Thousand Years of Islam. It's a book that accompanies the PBS documentary, Islam, the Empire of Faith. And in that book, Dr. Shelley writes, and this is part of the introduction, I think it's very appropriate for us to go into the first break today, dealing with that quote. And maybe slightly more than the first quote that I gave you. She said, and this is the opening words of that book, "The horrific events of September 11th, 2001 have forever changed the way Americans view Islam and Muslims. Even before those catastrophes, most Americans at the dawn of the third millennium associated the word Islam with a range of negative images, from turbaned terrorists to stern-faced mullahs exhorting the faithful to shun the temptations of Western civilization. The ghastly pictures of hijacked jetliners crashing into the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center, the shot of the gaping hole in the Pentagon, of the rubble in the Pennsylvania countryside have made things much worse. For news reports and interviews with pundits often imply that people who did these terrible deeds acted in the name of Islam, and that Muslims are somehow essentially different from the rest of us. The constant barrage of stories about a minuscule and aberrant minority has colored American perception of faith, a faith followed by more than 1 billion people, approximately one-fifth of the Earth's population. In the United States, Islam is the fastest growing religion, and there are now more American Muslims than Episcopalians. They are now us. In reality, Islam, which is only half a dozen centuries younger than Christianity, created a long and brilliant civilization that is responsible for much of the way we are today. For example, you are reading a book on sheets of paper, and its pages are numbered with Arabic numerals. Both of these inventions were brought to the West during the Middle Ages, thanks to Muslims. Given Islam's importance in the world today, all of us must try to approach it with more than old stereotypes. In this section, first segment, we have dealt with basically the idea, the whole question of civilizational identity. And we looked at Muslims as being integral components of the American pluralism. And we dealt with this whole idea of the globalization of Islam somewhat, for want of a better word, or rather the history of Islam and the dynamics of change. We addressed somewhat the myths of this Islamic threat and the fallacy of a clash of civilizations. And of course, actually the need to understand one another, not as one and the other, but actually as one. We are going for a break right now. And when we come back, we'll have a guest from overseas with us. I hope you are as invigorated and prepared for the next hour as you have been for the last. I'll be here after the break. I hope you'll be there. Be back shortly. Come back to Cal State University, Domingo Hills. We're coming live to you on channel LA36, on cable television locally and worldwide on the internet. I'm your instructor for the SBS 318 course. My name is Sadullah Khan. If you don't know by now, it's 11 weeks already. For God's sake, remember that. And this is part 11 of a 13-part program or series on Islamic culture and civilization. Today we are dealing with Islam or the Muslim presence in the West. Last week we dealt with Islam via Africa into America. And today we're continuing Muslim presence in the West. And dealing specifically now in the latter portion of today's program, we are going to deal with Muslims in the American pluralism. Muslims in the American pluralism. How Muslims from various parts of the world who are here, who are American, who are living here, people who are Americans who are of Muslim faith. In other words, not foreigners, not people who consider themselves foreign, who are as American as anyone else, some of whose origins may be from as diverse communities as the American pluralism allows, from Europe to China to Africa to Far East to Middle East to Canada. So in regards to the presence of Islam in America and the Muslim presence and Muslim involvement and participation in the American pluralism, I thought, let's look at some grassroots involvements and do some case study and look at some of the organizations and institutions and personalities involved at grassroots level. And today we have with us dear friend Sabiha Khan, who is the spokesperson for the Council on Islamic Council on American Islamic Relations. Oh man, KCAIR. Assalamu alaikum, Sabiha.
Wa alaikum salam.
Thanks for having. Thanks for coming and thanks for having me.
Thanks for inviting me on.
Yes, Sabiha has been on, I think you were on the media issue sometime, a few weeks ago, or quite a few weeks ago it was. And who would say we are in, it was section, I think, session 4 or 5, and we are in 11 already, time really goes. Yeah. Anyway, Sister Sabiha, you represent, you are a spokesperson for K, Council on Arab or American Islamic Relations, American Islamic Relations. What is CARE all about? Give me an idea as to, you know, what is it? What are you about? What is it? What is CARE?
Well, like you said, CARE stands for Council on American Islamic Relations. And basically, we're a grassroots national Muslim advocacy group. What that basically means is that CARE's mission is to inform people about Islam and Muslims. What we have encountered is that what often happens because of misinformation or ignorance about Islam, a lot of people don't understand Muslims and Islam, and it often leads to confusion and often negative consequences happen because of that. But aside from that, in terms of knowing your neighbor, Islam and Muslims, we feel it's very important for a society that prides itself on diversity. Just look all around you. Just in Southern California, you have people from all over the world. It's basically a mini United Nations in Southern California. Yes. And and the Muslim is an integral part. And what we want to do is challenge stereotypes, and in essence that helps everyone. When you challenge stereotypes, you're not just doing a favor for that certain group. What you're doing is really a favor for the whole of society, in that it promotes understanding. And when you have understanding, you have so much growth in terms of community. There's intellectual growth, there's economic, there's political, and there's
harmony.
All sorts of harmony. I mean, that when you have harmony, you're able to go forward as a society. And being Muslim and American, it's our duty to make sure that where we live, where we grow up, where we raise our children, we're integral part of the society.
I noticed that CARE that has all the billboards across Southern California. Is it Southern California or is it nationwide?
Right now, it's Southern California. It's a new program.
Yeah, there's billboards that you have about spread a smile or something of that nature, and you have all Muslims there, but all Americans. There's a variety of people which you're talking about.
Right.
You know, so speak to me a bit about that, about the billboards. I mean, what was it all about? It gives me an idea that. And there we have it on the on the television screen there. Oh, even a smile is charity. Yeah, so what is the purpose behind it? What does it say?
Basically, it says even a smile is charity, and we have smiling faces from all members of the Muslim community, and we wanted to show the range of diversity in all of the Muslim world. We have, you know, Asian Muslims, African Muslims, South Asian, white Muslims, just the whole spectrum. And what we wanted to bring out was unity in mankind. Basically, even a smile is charity. We all share that. We wanted to stress the common bond that we all have as Americans. And no matter what faith group, no matter what gender, we're all in the same human family. And it was it's the first of its kind in the nation, and we're very happy that it started in Southern California. And hopefully it brought about what Muslims are about, basically.
So I see you smile a lot.
Yeah. People tell me.
Well, I'm just telling you, what has the response been to that advert? It was very eye-catching. The first time I saw it, I didn't know that it was CARE, but it just felt good to look at something like this. And then I think the first time you came on the program and I saw some, there was even small cards given out to people or something.
Right. First, they were postcards.
Yeah.
So what we did was, it was a little bit different. It was our original design. And what we did was make them into postcards. And we had them at Human Relations County meetings, all different sorts of programs, and people loved it. It's a simple message that everybody can relate to. It's just our honor, the American Muslim community, just to bring it about in a time when we all need a reminder of just the humanity of each person.
Yes. How's the response been to it generally? I mean, the general response to it?
The majority of the people were very happy. They were ecstatic that, you know, good news for a change. Some good news about American Muslims. The Muslim as well as non-Muslim public was very, very happy with the whole campaign, and they actually wanted more.
Yeah, I think you spoke early on about stereotyping. I think it's very important for us to understand that sometimes stereotyping is from both sides.
Right.
It's also very important that sometimes in engaging people, it also sometimes people who accuse others of stereotyping them, they themselves are stereotyping the others, and you know, it makes it the general thing of us and them. And as Professor Esposito mentioned, they are us and we are them. And this banner, poster, or postcard, which you have put up there now, it's just something which is, it shows that you transcend that. This is it. This is we. You know, you're not a particular category. You are an American. You are of different backgrounds. Doesn't matter. You are here, and you happen to be Muslim.
Exactly, and that's the message that we hope went across and continues to reverberate across the community, that we are us, you know, we are them and they are us. Basically, we are one community. We want the good of the community just like anybody else.
So what is the role of the, I'm speaking about American Muslim now, I'm speaking about a variety of people who all happen to be American. And this is the question, you know, the development of the American Muslim identity. That you know that you are, ideologically, you are Muslim wherever you may be, whether you're South Africa or in America or in China. You ideologically, you belong to the faith that you are Muslim. But geographically, nationally, you are an American. What is the role, do you think, from your experience being involved at grassroots level with an organization that's so widespread and so well known? one of the large organizations in our country, by the way, Islamic organizations. What is the role of the American Muslim according to your institution, your organization, and what do you think?
Like you said, CARE is the largest grassroots organization. And as I was saying, it's an exciting time in America. You know, we see different faces from different ethnicities, religious background, you name it. We have a different person from a country, and that does not bar you from being an American. Mm-hmm. And what CARE
sees... Nor does being American bar you from being a Muslim.
Exactly. Yeah. And the people, and that's what we hope to accomplish in making that understanding that you can be American and Muslim. It doesn't have to be an oxymoron. Mm-hmm. You can be a good American Muslim at the same time. Mm-hmm. And then what we want to see is just to create a strong America, just like any other American. We want to see America that's prosperous, that aims beyond just tolerance. Because I could say, you know, I tolerate you, but that doesn't mean I accept you as a person. Mm-hmm. And we want to be able to show the community at large that, okay, this is what American Muslims are, this is who we are. And, you know, if you understand somebody, then you start accepting them. And so when you have acceptance, then it's easier to go on from there as a community. And the more tolerance, and I mean, the more acceptance that you get, the less, you know, we hear about civil rights being, you know, hammered on for American Muslim community and so forth. And unfortunately, you know, because we have so much work as a community in bringing that understanding to America at large, you know, we've been through obstacles, and one part is defending the civil rights of American Muslims. And a lot of people these days are, you know, I don't want to be critical, but a lot of people are saying, well, it's okay. If it's somebody else's civil rights, then that's fine, as long as I'm okay. But, you know, basically justice denied to one is justice denied to everyone. Yes. And American Muslims see themselves as the vanguard of protecting civil liberties and civil rights in this country. Mm-hmm. You know, the country is built upon equality for each person, and American Muslims are I guess blessed in that we are learning to be in the forefront, because just as if you defend one community's civil rights, then the whole community benefits and prospers from that. Yeah. And you know, if one group is marginalized, you know, it just can't be a good thing for America. And one reactive work is for civil rights, and we've been documenting the hate crimes, and
something about the hate crimes. Of course, since September 11th, even before that, by the way, yeah. I mean, since the Timothy McVeigh thing, the Oklahoma bombing, for example, but September 11th thing just made it now. Has there been an increase in hate crimes? How do you respond to that? Are you called upon to respond to that kind of thing? And how do you respond to it? What are the kinds of crimes? What are the kinds of issues you're talking about?
Well, you know, one part of CARE's work after September 11th was very reactive, because we were in a state of shock, and, you know, we really didn't know what was going on. And one thing was documenting the hate crimes. And unfortunately, I think the number is over 1,700 since September 11th across the nation.
1,700.
Yeah. And, what we want to do is learn from, the vast majority of Americans are wonderful, and I have to say that. We had calls coming in that people were so supportive. They're like, they could distinguish between madmen and just the average American Muslim. And that really brought a lot of hope in American Muslims that, you know, we are a part of this society, and there are good people. Most people are good, and just like you were saying, don't stereotype on other people. American Muslims realize that we can't stereotype the American public. You know, most people are good, and just like we ask others not to stereotype us.
Yes,
it's reciprocal.
And I'll take a call on the line, Samiha. I'll take a call on the line. Just your name and question briefly. Chuck from Woodlands. Go ahead, Chuck.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, Chuck.
Yes. The question I have is if the Muslim population continues to grow. I'm in Woodland Hills, and there are a lot of Muslims here. There are Muslim. I have Muslim neighbors.
Yeah.
What sort of institutional changes would Muslims introduce into our system as a consequence of, say, having the political power to do it? I mean, you know, protecting civil rights is serve a noble goal, but there are practical issues. For example, uniform voting codes, would these be imposed? What about crimes of sexuality, or would we have new crimes of sexuality? Would homosexuals be persecuted, or would what sort of changes in our institutions? What sort of things would happen in our daily lives if the country began to become Islamic?
Yeah, I think I may respond to that. First of all, what would happen if the Christian country become Christian, by the way? They were supposed to, I think it's a very interesting question. I think I appreciate your question, Chuck, and I'm sure you're asking.
Well, I mean, things have happened because...
Where in America, for example? Chuck, give me an example in America, in the 300 years of Muslim presence here and 80 years of immigration Muslim presence here. We have not been able to have any real political power so far yet. We don't have a single congressperson. No, a single senator, by the way. We have one mayor that we know of, and a few chaplains in prisons. So I think, very briefly, I think this part of the fear when Muslims come in, they'll cut off the hands of the thief and they will stone them. I think these are biblical things as well, by the way. So let's not be, let me be honest about what we're trying to ask about. If Muslims come here, this is the country, there are rules and regulations, there's a constitution. When you come here, when you vote, you know what you are voting for. You try to uphold moral values to the best of your ability. I'm not a homosexual. I myself don't promote gay rights. Gays want to have their rights, they're welcome to that. I will not perform a gay marriage. My religion doesn't permit me to perform gay marriages. But if gays want to get married, they've got the right to do so. So I cannot impose it on other people. I can express my opinion about things. But this kind of idea that, you know, some, when Muslims suddenly take over the country, what happens if Jews take over the country? What happens if Orthodox Jews take over the country? What happens if Jerry Falwell takes over the country? What happens if Pat Robertson takes over the country? What happens if the people like David Koresh take over the country? James Jones. So I think we must be very cautious. When talking about Islam, we don't look at the most, the extreme, for example. There are Muslim presence. How many Muslims are there in the country? 6 million out of, 6 to 7 million out of 250 million. I think, Chuck, you shouldn't worry so much about that. Look, you have Muslim neighbors, by the way. Meet with them. Go to the mosques. Go to the centers. See what they're about, rather than fearing. You know, I'm from South Africa, by the way. The Dutch Reformed Church institutionalized apartheid. I don't fear Christianity, though the Christian church in my country endorsed it. I never hated the Christian. I went to a Catholic school. I have no problem with the Catholics. I have no problem with the Christians. People who brought the slaves over to this country brought them in ships called Good Ship Jesus, Holy Mary, as an example. I don't fear when I come over here that, oh, these Christians are... No, separate what happens in history, separate particular parts of the world, separate what is the reality. You are living in Woodland Hills, as you say. There are many Muslims. What are their attitude? Are they coming and badgering you? Are they trying to impose their views upon you? I find many people coming to knock on my door, or from the Christian church, trying to insist I buy some books and so on. I tolerate that. I don't see that as an imposition. But at the same time, I think you must realize that people who are in this country, wherever they may be, for example, in particular here, they are maybe Muslims. And people have moral values and so on and so forth. As regards the political setup, we have clear guidelines. What is permissible, what the laws are, what is the constitution, and you abide by that. Otherwise, you will not be elected, you wouldn't come to power. So we need to be very clear, and who will vote for people like that? So we need to be very clear about that. I think Muslim presence is just a presence of people who happen to be of the Muslim faith, who have moral values like Christians, like Jews, like people of other faiths. They happen to be Muslim, and they are Americans. By the way, many of them are Afro-American. So some people may be feared who are prejudiced. What about the blacks take over? Because the majority of Muslims in America are black, by the way. So some may be prejudiced and say, what about the black take over? You don't hear that very much mentioned because you sound too prejudiced. But it's easy to target Arabs and Middle Easterners because they are now the easy targets. So let's be clear about that. When you say Muslims, majority of Muslims are blacks. Are you going to bring up the issue of blacks? Or is it not kosher right now to mention those terms? So let's be clear how we separate our prejudice from reality. Yes, if Muslims are in your neighborhood, if they are good Muslims, if they are good Christians, good Jews, it's good for everyone. If it can be bad Muslims, imposing Christians or Jews, it'll be bad for everyone. It's not their faith that makes them so, it's what they are and what they do that'll make them so. We have a question that someone asked here, a questioner. What kinds of prejudice have you experienced from people your own age? For example, at school, at work, and so on. They assume you're at school.
Yeah. Little do they know. I've been lucky that I work with in a Muslim environment, so it's kind of hard to be prejudiced against Muslim if you're Muslim. But
it happens, though.
But it can happen. It can happen. That's true. Personally, I haven't seen it. I've not experienced prejudice. I might have and not know it, maybe in a very subtle way. But for me, just about my daily life, I haven't experienced prejudice, which is not to say that other people haven't.
Yes.
I know people have gone through hard times at work, mm-hmm. Because they might have been fired because suddenly, the management was scared they're Muslim and they didn't tell them for whatever reason. And, suddenly they find themselves out of work. Or at school, I know that some kids have gone through a rough time because of their names. And I know of some kids who have gotten beaten up. And, if it's not, it can't be acceptable for any group to be, discriminated against like that. So it shouldn't be acceptable for Muslim, American Muslims as well. So it's really, we see it very imperative in terms of making our community, go forth in the right direction.
Yeah, I think from my side, I must say, for example, I'm involved both at UCLA, at USC as well, at Cal State Domingo Hills. And to be very frank with you, there have been reports of prejudice in many circles. I mean, that has happened. And I think after September 11th, immediately after the horrendous act, there was a tremendous outpouring of support. I think Christian, Jewish, and Muslim communities, maybe the leadership, I'm talking about Southern California in particular, unbelievable, unparalleled support and, coming together. In some parts, even some Christian and Jewish neighbors surrounded the mosque and, drove children to school. It was so heartwarming. As an academic circle that I'm involved in, and I'm involved, as I mentioned, at UCLA, USC, as well as here, very frankly, I must say, I've never experienced. Mm-hmm. In fact, I've experienced a lot of goodwill. Mm-hmm. But this is an academic circle. And, of course, you are teaching to students, so you don't find that kind of thing. What I do find, however, is the kind of questions that it's so much prejudice that you answer, what about the Middle East? As if I always say to Muslim people, why do you, when you ask about Islam, isn't the first Muslim come to your mind? Why isn't the first person Muhammad Ali that comes to your mind, who's a Muslim, American, well-known all over the world, well-known as an American hero, well-known as a Muslim hero? Why is Bin Laden the picture that comes to your mind? Why, in my mind, as a Catholic, I think of the Pope? Or I think of Cardinal Mahoney. I don't think of Hitler, for example. If I think of the Orthodox, I don't think of the Serbian Milosevic. So I just find that kind of prejudice is there. You're almost guilty by association. You're a Muslim, so the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm not a Middle Easterner. I'm from Africa, for God's sake.
Mm-hmm.
But the poor question is you have to answer, but you in the Middle East, but you Muslims. I mean, I've never lived, I lived in Egypt for some time, studying there. I was in exile for a while there.
Mm-hmm.
But, this kind of thing. So I think, what are some of the prejudices that you have that have been reported to you people, and how do you respond to it? How do you respond?
Well, we've had workplace discrimination or school discrimination.
What can you do about it?
Well, what we try to do is, first of all, the best way is communication. We find there's a lack of communication from either one side or the other. Maybe the employer doesn't understand the employee or vice versa. And so what we try to do is maybe through talking, maybe through getting the facts, people understand where they stand. And 99% of the time, it's resolved very successfully for both the employer and the employee or student. There are some cases where sometimes you have to, prove that, your civil rights have been, jeopardized. So in those cases, we have to, and people will fight in court in order to make sure that, civil rights or civil liberties haven't been infringed upon. And actually, I have a clip of our public relations director who was talking about a little bit about the cases and just basically about the billboard as well and what's CARE's work in the community.
So let's have a look at this report, Improving Relations.
Thank you. hate crimes against Arab Americans. Report. The Orange County Human Relations Commission reported 69 hate crime cases in 2001 compared to 8 a year earlier. Most of them occurred after September.
It does not reflect the overwhelming majority of the community. Those who commit these crimes are the fraction, are a minority. The majority of the community members continue to go along with their lives in a peaceful way, whether they're at school or at work or the general and public. And certainly they are committed to making Orange County a better place for all of its community members.
The Council on American Islamic Relations stepped up its community outreach programs, including creating billboard campaigns in an effort to create better relations between Arab Americans and the community at large.
Yeah, there we saw some short snippet of both the, what do you call it, the poster, what do you call it?
The billboard.
Billboard. I'm still a second South African English. Okay, anyway. Billboard. I must remember that. And Riyad Farah spoke about it. Give us some comment on what's all about.
Basically, he did. He was basically expounding upon, what is it in terms of hate crimes in specifically Orange County. But he also made emphasis on the fact that the majority of people. Of Americans have been supportive of American Muslims, and we're very appreciative of that. And that just shows the importance of American Muslims being a bridge between Muslims and non-Muslims, between American Muslims and the rest of America, as well as American Muslims, America and the rest of the Muslim world. We have this unique position in history that's never happened, in which we can serve as a liaison from the Muslim world to America. There are Muslims in the world who have this misperception that America is bad, and there are some. But a lot of them, we have to realize they make we have to show them that there's a difference between American foreign policy and American people themselves. And like I said, the Muslim community, American Muslim community, is in a unique position to make that distinction. And when we do that, there could only be good out of making a bridge of understanding between.
Now, how do you hope to build this bridge of understanding you're talking about? How do you anticipate sort of building that bridge? What?
Well, tiny steps.
That's a major task.
There's so many areas that we need to work upon. The three major areas that CARE works through is community relations. We work through media, civil rights, political work. In terms of community, what we do a lot of interfaith work. Even we talk to groups as small, churches as small as 50. We go to student groups and talk to maybe 20 people in a room. And just that personal level of meeting somebody else who is American Muslim, it makes a big difference. You realize that there's a human person standing in front of you who has the same goals, same desires as anybody else, and it makes that that connection between people. And then in terms of media, which I work specifically on, is we try to reach out, to maybe during our Ramadan, the fasting month, we try to educate the media about what is this month, why is it important. Try to be proactive in showing, this is how American Muslim life is. Of course, there's a lot of reactive work these days in terms of making sure that the record is straight about who Muslims are. And also we have civil rights. We've worked with different town hall meetings in terms of meeting FBI, INS, because there's a lot of apprehension in the American Muslim community about civil rights, about what's going on.
What are some of the things that are going on? Let me just hear about that. What are some of the things that are going on? Are Muslims being picked up and questioned and locked up? Is it happening? Because the impression one gets, the media doesn't really cover that very much, by the way. Mm. And when people are picked up, when they discuss and discussion in on television in specific, it's almost like, well, they were all released. Is that the case? What is the reality? Are people being picked up? Are the civil rights being violated? What is the situation?
I hate to be a harbinger of bad news, but the truth is there are a lot of Muslims who aren't citizens yet, or who are just on a green card, who are in jail, and for no, they don't know why. They don't know the names. Their ACLU is trying to fight for making the list known of who is in there. And unfortunately, it's not like on a list of outrageous things right now. In the
but all those who are held are some violation of the paperwork.
Oftentimes, it's minor. It's a violation. That's true.
But are there any who are held who don't have any violations? Do you know of any who are being held? We have no violations for the paperwork.
And that's what we're trying to find out. There's a lot of secrecy involved right now. And obviously, there's going to be apprehension inside the community about what's going on. And so CARE has, you know, worked with other civil rights organizations, including ACLU, to find out who people are and hopefully bring, you know, justice, that the United States is built upon justice. So
tell me, what are the numbers, more or less, of people who have been picked up or locked up?
I think it's about in the hundreds, but again, like I said, nobody knows for sure.
Okay, hundreds could be 200, 300, could be. I heard up to 1,200, I've heard.
Yeah.
Could be around about that. Okay, now, what are the major areas that CARE tries to help American society understand? What are the major areas in which you feel, you know, you try to, for example, I mean, you spoke about the media, informing them, you work with government level. Before I go to that question, and ask, do you work very much with Christian and other Jewish organizations? And I mean, do you find Christian leadership and Jewish leadership, for example, rabbis or priests or people in key positions cooperating with you? Are they of any help, or do they come forward of offer help and so on, knowing what you are doing?
Actually, the faith groups have been awesome, basically. We've worked with Christians, Christian leaders, Jewish leaders, Hindu, Sikh, you name it. We've worked with different faith groups and to build that bridge of understanding. And
is it open? Is it very free?
It's very open, and you'd be surprised. They're probably the most supportive people in terms of understanding what's going on. You know, faith really helps people through tough times, no matter what faith you belong to. And, you know, in terms of interfaith, that's our work. And then, again, like I was saying, with civil rights, making sure that, you know, everything's in order in terms of America's, you know, constitution, because that's why American Muslims are here, because they believe in what America's about, you know, freedom, all the freedoms guaranteed in the Constitution, in the Bill of Rights, and a lot of times, like I told you, discrimination in the workplace, and CARE has worked on some some cases in this area, and actually we have another
video footage.
Video about basically what CARE is about.
Yeah, okay. Show some. We have a video, just basically what CARE is generally all about, and then we can have some maybe concluding remarks. And I have so many questions to go. But we can have a look at the video on just overview of what CARE is all about. Let's go ahead.
CARE has resolved several workplace discrimination issues involving many well-known national companies. When a U.S. Air grounds crew worker was told not to wear her hijab, she called CARE and was ultimately allowed to keep her job and her headscarf. CARE then helped provide Anjum Smith's name to the Senate committee investigating religious freedom in the workplace.
Taking off that scarf would have been like taking off my shirt.
After testifying on Capitol Hill, a grateful Smith passed out CARE pamphlets to committee staffers. Indeed, it's thanks to determined efforts like these to raise awareness. Scenes like this of women in hijab are becoming more and more common, now part of the everyday American landscape. Muslim American women like this Ohio physician.
We feel that CARE makes a difference, that they are showing results within the Muslim community, and they are making us proud to be Muslims, and the fact that they, following Islam and the Quran, are able to make a difference in the society, in American society.
The publication Anjum Smith passed out when testifying before Congress was one of several compiled by CARE. The Employer's Guide to Islamic Religious Practices was sent to the largest companies in the United States. The Companion Educator's Guide, which encourages school officials to be sensitive to Muslim holidays and practices, is also having an impact.
They have requested from us a list of major Muslim holidays, and we've sent it to them, and they're putting that on their calendar.
Also, every member of Congress received CARE's annual report on the status of Muslim civil rights in America. All of this is why CARE's internship program is so critical. CARE realizes it's vital to train the next generation to carry the torch into the next century. With God's help, CARE has been able to bring much overdue political clout to the Muslim community. Its executive director sits on the president's advisory panel on civil rights to the White House Commission on Aviation Safety and Security. It was in this role that Kerr was able to convince officials not to use body imaging, an X-ray-like machine that allows airport security to see through clothes to the bare body. Indeed, a letter from President Clinton even thanked Kerr for its guidance during the TWA crisis. The group's work no doubt influenced Clinton's speech urging religious tolerance in the workplace, specifically the right to wear hijab at work and to put the Quran on your desk.
Today I'm instructed.
Kindly comment on what we have seen there. I think you went to the highest levels. I mean, you spoke early on about Kerr's involvement, and here you see a presentation at the highest level to the government as well. How does the government, first of all, the first question is, before you give us an overview of what's all about that you have seen, how is the government response? I mean, is Kerr well received? And
In the beginning, the president came out and he basically gave support to the Muslim community. If you remember, he was in the Muslim mosque right after September 11th, and exactly with George Bush, which was very good. It I think it really helped in terms of keeping fears and so forth down. But basically, after that, we started getting mixed messages. We weren't sure what was going on in terms of, civil rights, civil liberties, because secret evidence, which is basically not telling the person who's accused what is evidence against them so that they could be, so they could defend against the evidence, started being used in terms of people who are in jail and so forth. So Muslim community, has started criticizing the presidency right now because we feel that, on one hand, there is no war against Islam, but on the other hand, we're seeing a lot of our charities close down, a lot of our people in jail, a lot of the institutions that we believe are mainstream America have been closed down. And so a lot of American Muslims are feeling hurt and not so sure about what is the message that's coming from the White House. But keeping that in mind, we realize that we have to constantly be engaged with civic society, and American Muslims realize that we need to constantly be part of any, government, Congress, anything to do with America, because we are American Muslims and we have a stake in the future of our country.
Now, one of the things you mentioned early on, one of the terms that you mentioned, and I was going to take you to task on that one there, I think maybe I can do that right now. The idea of empowering, and we spoke about reducing prejudice from one side to the other, and often there's prejudice on both sides, as you mentioned as well. But as a community, to understand the Muslim community is not like a monolithic community, just one group of people or one culture, one ideology perhaps, but not one culture or one expression. But how does Kerr work towards the empowerment? I mean, whatever levels of empowerment there may be, what is the level, how do you approach the idea of empowerment itself, besides beyond the Muslim community, within the Muslim community itself? I mean, because that also needs to be addressed. Mm-hmm. Might be multifaceted, as you mentioned, that you are doing. What are you doing to empower the Muslim community itself, or the community itself?
Well, like you said, there's a long history of American Muslims, over 300 years in this country. But the most recent wave of immigration, within the last 80 years. So a lot of, we have a lot of new Americans, the first generation, my parents' generation, who came here to study to have a better life. And so with any new generation, you have to learn how the system works so that you can be a productive member of society. And what Kerr does is try to empower the individual. And when I say empower, is basically, basically show people the importance of being part of the political system, because our vote counts, because what happens in the White House, in Congress, affects not only American Muslims, but all of America. American Muslims have the same, worries just like anybody else. Good schools, is there, the crime rate, low crime rate,
tax.
Low poverty taxes, not to mention that. And just basic issues that affect daily life, American Muslims. And so what we try to do is help educate the American Muslim community about how it works, what's important, why should we vote, after that, how to vote, basically things to do with civic life, in terms of civil rights, knowing your civil rights. A lot of people may not know because they came from another country where they felt, where they were suppressed in terms of their civil rights. So when they come to the United States, they might not have known the full gamut of what's allowed to them and what's not. And empowering the Muslim community in terms of media, you know, telling people that we as American Muslims have a duty to inform our community about who we are. So, you know, engaging newspapers, writing letters to the editor, you know, writing articles in newspapers. It's very important to be an active member of society. We suffered in that we felt like, and I'll just speak as the whole community, we felt like, okay, if we stay in our homes and just mind our own business, everything will be okay. Well, everything wasn't okay after 9/11, and that was part of the problem. We let ignorance happen. We let, our bubble, we thought it would shield us, but guess what? It burst after 9/11. And so we realized that even more so, to be engaged with the community, because and that's part of a Muslim's duty, to be engaged in the community. It's, you know, first individual, then family and society. And so to be a true American Muslim, you need to be engaged with your own community.
Mm-hmm. And what about internal empowerment? I mean, is externally talking about, but internally, how do you look at that? What role do you play in that? I mean, I involved with religious organizations as well, trying to look at the spiritual, you know. I mean, so maybe your job, but I mean, you try to incorporate that as part of the...
Well, of course, since we are an American Muslim grassroots organization, we will follow according to our religion, you know. Mm. That's the whole point, basically, to be able to... And which doesn't mean, you know, you can't be American and Muslim at the same time, like I said. But... And also, like, externally, talking about making sure, you know, challenging the stereotypes that there are out there, you know, educating others, people through church organizations, through, you know, Jewish organizations, so forth, through civil rights organization, community organizations, basically to build the community, making sure that people are part of it. I know that a lot of people have joined a lot of clubs that they realize that, you know what, it's time I started being a productive member of society.
Okay.
So CARE helps enhance and maybe gives a push to the community to realize that.
One of the problems we have with recent immigrants, I mean, talking about the second and third and fourth waves maybe, you know, after the 1920s and so on and so forth, specifically those coming from the Far East and from the Middle East in particular, that there hasn't been a complete integration somewhat, it seems. That somewhat, some of them still have the... Of course, there are cultural expressions. But unlike the earlier Muslims who came here, the African Muslims who came here, or the European Muslims who came here, or the early Middle Eastern Muslims who came here before 1900 and 19, before that time, those who came in the 20s and after the First World War and so on, that many of them are strongly cultural, which almost identify them as something separate, even within the Muslim community, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that that's sometimes an obstacle that people somehow still, some of them, I mean, I'm talking about the recent immigrants, have the mentality that, you know, I'm here, but that is still home, and that needs to be overcome in order for them to become truly effective and productive members of the society. Do you find that to be true?
Well, if we look at American history itself, we notice that with all groups, with all immigrants, you know, there was the Germans, there's the Italians, and African Americans, and so forth. So it's normal. It's just a human tendency to stay with people you know, you understand.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge is to learn how to break away. I mean, it doesn't mean you can't go back to your comfort zone of people who you identify with, but it also means that there's a challenge in terms of breaking away to be able to make your own ground, make your own, you know, be part of American society. We look all around us. You know, America's not just about different minority groups all stuck in under one country. We're diverse in thinking, in ethnic, in different ways, but we're also, America is a country where all of this comes together, and it comes together beautifully. I mean, we are the world's leading country in terms of economic, political, etc. And so American Muslims, I think, are realizing that you don't have to be separate. I hate the term melting pot, but that's what we are ending up to become. That doesn't mean we don't keep our identities of who we are. Never, you know, disregard who you are just to become part of something. Keeping who you are as well as being part of the society.
And I think, you know, what you are is what you are, but also is what you become in the process and how you contribute to a becoming. You know, you can always be a Christian, always be a Muslim, always be a Buddhist, or whatever it may be, and you may have certain cultural tendencies and backgrounds, but how do those varieties contribute? After all, America is a melting pot, as you mentioned, and specifically Los Angeles, by the way, is the most cosmopolitan city in the world, for that matter. And I always tell in my class, you know, in this class, if I ask a typical American to stand up, you'll be surprised. There, you know, there's a variety. You know, I have Japanese students in my class, Arab students in my class, students from the Gulf region, students from Mexico, from Canada, Afro-Americans, Africans, and so on and so forth. I'm the only South African there, by the way, but there's something else. Any parting comments, last comments before I let you go, Sabiha?
I think we are in a special time. American Muslims are going to have to make the effort, and the American community make the effort in terms of bridging understanding, making understanding, learning about one another. You know, the benefits will be countless in terms of once we understand and realize that, you know, we have a common goal. What's our common goal is basically to make life better for everybody, for our generation and the future generations, and learn how to work together. And I think the sooner we realize that, sooner we work on it, the better we are all for it.
Thank you very much. That's Sabiha Khan from Council on American Islamic Relations at last. CARE, I just said CARE. Thank you very much for some insight into what CARE is doing and an example of what Muslim involvement at grassroots level in this part of the world and part of the American pluralism. Just for the benefit of our students, the assignment, which is the major assignment for the for the grade for this course, it's an essay on Islam in America. The essay will be Islam in America. And I want a reference to the universality of Islam, the basic overview of the Islamic contribution university, also the history of Islam in America in particular, the diversity of Muslims that are found here, the growth of Islam in America, and of course, the dilemma faced by Muslims vis-a-vis stereotyping and media bias somewhat, and specifically since September 11th, and also the need for understanding and acceptance. I repeat, the theme is Islam in America. Essay of approximately 2,500 to 3,000 words, about 7 type pages, hopefully. Write an essay on Islam in America, making reference to the universality of Islam, history of Islam in America, diversity of Muslims found in America, the growth of Islam in America, the dilemma faced by Muslims in America, especially since September 11th, and the need for understanding and acceptance. The due date for the assignment is May the 7th, 2002. That's this year. May 7th, 2002. And the following considerations will determine the grade. Is the paper well-researched? Originality? Does the body of the paper adhere to the goals put forth in the introduction? Linguistic and grammatical propriety? Is the conclusion based on information presented in the body of the paper? And of course, neatness. And of course, delivering the assignment on time. So due date, May the 7th, 2002. The essay, Islam in America, 2,500 to 3,000 words. It should be in by May 7th. I thank you once again, Sabiha Khan. We'll be having a break right now, and we'll be coming back with another guest. And don't go away. I'll be here, and I hope you'll be there too. Back after the break. Welcome back to Islamic Culture and Civilization. We're coming live to you from Cal State University, Domingo Hills. I'm your instructor, Sadullah Khan, for the SBS 318 course. This is the last segment of the last session of a 13-session program called Islamic Culture and Civilization. And, of course, today we've dealt with the theme civilizational identity. In the last hour, we spoke to Dr. Nagwa Hidayah from the Hidayat Institute for Arabic Studies in Egypt. And she's also a visiting overseer and teacher and director for Arabic programs here at some of the centers in Los Angeles, California. Some of the points that you dealt with, some of the themes that you discussed in the first hour were was Muslims as integral components of the American pluralism, history of Islam and the dynamics of change, the myth of the Islamic threat, the fallacy of the class of civilizations, and also of course now we touched upon it somewhat throughout the last part of the first segment, and then of course much of the second segment, and now also hopefully in this portion of the program, building bridges towards a better future. My guest here was the guest that I had on the first program, a very, very dear friend of mine, one whom I respect for his knowledge, and also someone who's very very much involved in the community. I introduced to you Sheikh Yasir Fazaga, Imam at the Orange County Islamic Foundation. Sheikh Yasir, welcome. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Good to have you, brother.
Good to be with you again.
It's a pleasure always to have you.
And
yeah, so you're looking good.
Thank you. I am really honored for being your first guest and your last guest. And on behalf of all the people that have benefited from this course, I really, really want to thank you greatly. It truly has made an impact, not only for the Muslims as well as the non-Muslims as well.
Yes.
And I believe that it's programs like these that really will help in building the bridge that you're talking about. So on their behalf, thank you very much.
Thank you, thank you. Thank you for your kind gesture and for your expression of those kind sentiments. You know, we don't have so much time. We have gone into quite a bit of time. We only have about half an hour left for this program or so. But let's see some of the points that we need to look at. One of the things that, you know, I think I brought it up in the first program that we had, and then subsequent to that, it seems to be recurring somewhat as a question, somewhat as a degree of uncertainty. The question of the identity of Muslims, I think you referred to it in the first program as well. But the question that I wish you to maybe clarify, or the response that I maybe solicit from you, is that being a Muslim does not prevent you from being a good Muslim doesn't prevent you from being a good citizen wherever you are, provided whatever you abide by are not something which are immoral or improper or unjust. Am I correct in that?
By all means, by all means. And I think that there was a statement that I believe, remember, that was made on the first program here, and that is, if what you believe in does not impact how you behave, then probably it's not very important. And one of the things that Islam really stresses a lot on is the fact that how does you being a Muslim impact you, and how does that resemble itself as far as you're dealing with the rest of humanity, with the rest of the creation of God. So I, in Islam, looking into the tradition, be it in the Quran or the Sunnah of the Prophet, peace be upon him, you're not only asked to be a good citizen to your fellow human beings, but rather you're asked to be a good, you know, a good person to the rest of the creation of God, be it the nature, environment, animals, plants, what have you. And we also have a tradition how the Prophet, peace be upon him, when he was fleeing, when he was kicked out of Mecca to Medina, it said that he looked back. And he said that about Mecca, the city of Mecca, that it was the dearest place for him. And knowing that your Islam or your relationship with God is not really bounded to a specific area.
Yes.
But then he made the statement that Mecca is a very dear place to him.
Yes.
So there is no really contradiction between you being a good Muslim and also at the same time being a good citizen.
So you there's no harm in being geographically and nationally being a Nigerian, for the matter, and being a good Muslim.
So
ideologically, by being Muslim, does not deter you from being a good citizen of the country.
By all means. You know, it's interesting you say this, because I remember when we were doing the study of Hadith, the tradition of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and they spoke of how the scholars would travel from one place to another, you know, collecting the statements of the Prophet or the tradition. And a scholar may have a name, so-and-so, al-Basri, Al-Kufi, Al-Iraqi, they had this thing that you become a citizen of a certain area or for locality if you spend any time between 3 to 5 years there. And now you're branded by, you're given a nickname that you are a citizen of that area. So people who have traveled, you know, to more than one place, they were given more than one nickname. So today you're this and so, Nigerian, later on American, later on Canadian, and it was... This was not really something that, like you said earlier, there is really no contradiction. Rather, it is something that is expected.
Yes. Second thing is that, what do you think? You know, I think that Dr. Nagua spoke early on about the idea of, you know, language, a means of communication. Communication leads to understanding to tolerance and appreciation. We looked at that. What do you think that Muslims need to do? You know, you are a religious scholar and you're also a leader of a large community, an influential person as such, by the grace of God. What I need to know from you is, what do you think that Muslims need to do to be better understood? There's always a complaint, we're not understood. Mm-hmm. But I think a large part of that burden rests upon the Muslim community as well. Mm-hmm. If that's the case, and if you agree with that to some extent, then what do you feel that Muslims need to do to be understood? What is it?
You know, that also reminds me. Remember, we said that the way America knew about Islam was always through headline news. Mm-hmm. A catastrophe took place where a Muslim was blamed for it, mm-hmm. and that's how people came to know about Islam. I think, be it your show, be it the interaction, the personal interaction that people have been making with our fellow citizens, mm-hmm. you know, Americans, that has a great impact. And that is, people can watch all they watch on TV, and that is really what is shaping their thoughts and feelings with regard to who the Muslims are. But what really I find to be most impactful is Muslims dealing with non-Muslims. Mm-hmm. How do they project themselves? You know, mm-hmm. how do they behave? What kind of Islam are they really presenting to the non-Muslims? And the stories are many. You would find that people, you know, with their coworkers, people at school, in my own school, that's been going on, and it seems like it is the part of knowledge. And I think. I think I told you of the small, of the little girl that was watching television with her mother.
Right.
And as the planes were diving into the World Trade Center, and she said, "Mom, why did they do this to us?" Mm. And she said, "It's because they hate us." And she said, "Well, why do they hate us?" She said, "It's because they don't know us." So the young girl said, "Well, can we write our names on a piece of paper and hand it to them?" It sounds very childish and very naive. Oh,
very deep.
Exactly. There is a lot of truth.
Of wisdom in that.
Into that. And simply, it is human's nature, and that is, people, or like they say, ignorance breeds fear. Mm-hmm. And that is really what is happening. Mm-hmm. But I think that after September the 11th, people are genuinely interested in knowing more about Islam, for whatever reason it is. Why do they hate us? Why did they do this to us? Or what have you? And I think that we have a golden opportunity. Like you said, we complain about we're not being understood. And the sad reality is that Muslims, we have never taken the time to introduce ourselves to other people. Mm-hmm. Now, if I can say, you know, if there is anything good that is coming out of this tragedy, is the fact that people are willing to learn more about one another. And I see us Muslims now are given the golden opportunity to introduce ourselves to others, because others are, for the first time, are genuinely interested in knowing who we are.
Mm-hmm. That's very important. You know, I have an extract here. You know, Dr. Chris Reddy, I wrote a book called The Muslim Mind. Chris Reddy is an Australian scholar. He wrote a book called The Muslim Mind. And he's a person who's traveled all over the world and so on and so forth. And in the book, The Muslim Mind, towards the end of the book, he writes about Islam and the West. And towards the end part of the book, he quotes one of the well-known, renowned Islamic scholars, Dr. Abul Hasan Ali Nadwi, mm-hmm. director of Nadwatul Ulama in Islamic University in Lucknow, which is in India. And of course, you know, Nadwi wrote a book called Islamic Western Civilization, Islam and the Muslims. And he says this in the conclusion, as part of his book. So I'd like you to comment on that. I'll just read the quote and then you tell me what you think about it. Very much in keeping with what you've said. He said, "The past history of the Islamic countries, the indestructible attachment of the Muslim masses everywhere to Islam, the ideals which inspired them in the struggle for freedom, all these things demand that Islamic values should have a claim on their leadership. On the other hand, the intellectual makeup, education, and political interest of the ruling classes in Muslim countries require that Western forms of life should be pushed forward. The attitude of rejection and withdrawal is emphatically futile. It is bound to fail. No nation can aspire to maintain its individuality which lacks faith in itself and is plagued with an inferiority complex. All its efforts to hold its ground against a mighty civilization, which has also become the dominant trend of the time, must ultimately fail. In contrast, there is the philosophy of defeatism, capitulation, servility. Its advocates are ardent, though immature, disciples of the West, of modernism, which modernism to them means westernization. Now comes the crux. A man who does not take the West as his preceptor and relegates himself to the rank of a pupil, but treats the West as an associate, making his own contribution, He ought to know that if he has to learn a great deal from the West too has to learn no less from him. His endeavor should be to bring about a synthesis between the material and spiritual forces of the West and the East, and then to evolve from it a way of life the West may also be compelled to adopt, which may serve as an inspiration to the most highly advanced nations of the present day world, East and West. In other words, not the idea of master and slave or superior or inferior, which somehow of antagonism, but as co-workers, as co-civilizationalists, for want of a better word, that to work together to evolve understanding rather than looking at, you know, as one another in a separate way, that we are, our destinies are intertwined. How do I, as a Muslim, living in the West, a Westerner, by the way, I'm not an Easterner or anything else, how then do I contribute, and how should my my contribution be accepted? Do you agree with what Dr. Nabi said here?
I thought it was beautifully said. And like you said earlier also, it should not be a relationship where there is superiority or inferiority complex going on. As a Muslim, I believe that I can keep my own Muslim beliefs, creed, and practices, mm-hmm. and at the same time contribute to the society that I am living in, mm-hmm. no matter what that society is. In fact, one of the most beautiful prayers in the Quran,
yes,
were mentioned by Isa alayhi salam.
Jesus peace be upon him.
He was numbering the bounties of God upon him, and he said, "وَجَعَلَنِي مُبَارَكًا أَيْنَمَا كُنْتُ." And he said that of the bounties of God upon me is that he made me a blessed person, meaning a person that was beneficial to people wherever I went.
This is the words of Jesus in the
These
Quran.
These are the words of Jesus, peace be upon him, in the Quran. Mm-hmm. So now I look into this and I say, subhanAllah, you know, praise be to Allah. Mm. This is so beautiful. Mm-hmm. This is one of the missions of a Muslim, and that is wherever you may be, what is your contribution? Mm-hmm. And we saw this in the life of our Prophet, peace be upon him, and also in the life of all Muslims when we had that great civilization, and that is wherever they went, they somewhat contributed to the betterment of the society that they were living in. Yes. Now, unfortunately, I see that, you know, it happens that some people don't value what they have, or sometimes don't even know the value of what they possess. And there is a beautiful statement that I read, I'm not sure who said it, but he said that no one can make you feel inferior without your consent. Mm-hmm. And many people, unfortunately, are like that. For some reason, they look up to the technological advancement that were accomplished in the West, and they cannot be denied. But that is not necessarily how superiority and inferiority are measured. Mm. So as a Muslim, like you said earlier, maybe I was born in the East, but now I am in the West. As a Westerner Muslim, whatever that means, what are my contributions to my community and to my society?
Mm-hmm. You know, talking about the contribution, I've got a snippet here. It's from a book called World Civilizations. The book is called World Civilizations, The Global Experience. It's by Professor Peter Stern from George Mason University, Michael Eddes from Rutgers University, Stuart Schwartz from Yale University, and Mark Gilbert from North Georgia College State University. And in the section dealing with Islam, this is now the book called World Civilizations and the Global Experience. It's dealing with all civilizations throughout history. And you talk about the contribution of Islam. It's all appropriate for me to quote this part here. And under the section, under the heading called The Measure of Islamic Achievement, they write, although political power steadily passed to other groups within the Muslim community, the Arab accomplishments were stunning. Not only had the largely nomadic people from the Arabian backwater built one of the greatest empires of the pre-industrial world, but they had laid the basis for the first truly global civilization, if one excludes the Americas, which were unknown to the people of the Eastern Hemisphere at that time. Building on earlier religious traditions, especially Christianity and Judaism, Islamic culture, Arab culture had nurtured Islam, one of the great universal religions of humankind. The mosques, the prayer rituals and pilgrimage of the faithful, and the influence of the Islamic law proclaimed the pervasive effects of this new creed on societies from Spain to Eastern Indonesia, from Central Asia to the savannas of West Africa. In the arts and sciences, the Muslims initially relied heavily on the achievements of the classical civilizations of Greece and Mesopotamia. But the work of preserving and combining the discoveries of earlier peoples soon led to the reformulation and to innovation. As in religion and politics, Muslim people were soon making important contributions to learning, inventions, and artistic creativity, which were carried by their armies and religious teachers to other civilizations in Europe, to Africa, and Asia. Never before had a civilization spanned so many different cultures and combined such a patchwork of linguistic groups, religions, and ethnic types. I repeat that part. Never before had a civilization spanned so many different cultures and combined such a patchwork of linguistic groups, religions, and ethnic types. Never before had a single civilization mediated so successfully between the other centers of civilized life. Never had a civilized lifestyle so deeply affected so many of the nomadic cultures that surrounded the pools of sedentary agriculture and urban life. This is a quote from World Civilizations, The Global Experience. So from that you can see from the outset, the whole approach, Islam from the outset as a religion and a way of life was meant to be civilizational. And as a civilization from the outset, it was inclusive.
By all means.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, it's real interesting. I remember one time we were doing a paper in one of the classes when I was back in doing my Islamic studies. And one of them had to do with foreign relations between nations. To find out that there is actually a committee in the United Nations that holds the friends of Muhammad ibn Hassan al-Shaybani. Mm-hmm. And in appreciation to his work in the field of foreign relations between nations, they said that he was the first one, a Muslim from the Hanafi school of thought,
yes.
Said that he was the first person that ever wrote on this subject, foreign relations between countries. And they said that in appreciation to his work, they formed this committee in the United Nations, and now you can join as a member, the Friends of Muhammad ibn Hassan al-Shaybani. So, not only that, it's a great civilization, but it also, it's a very old, its contributions to mankind has been very old. On the, you know, basis of individuals like Ibn Khaldun, you know, you and Dr. Najwa talked about earlier, the first person that ever spoke about sociology and what have you. And civilization, they go to Razi and all these people. The contribution is there. It has been made. For some reason, you know, we are lacking at this point. But it is true. You're talking about 1.2 or 1.4 billion people, different cultures from different, you know, walks of life, ethnicities and what have you. But Islam was able to combine all these people and make out this beautiful, great civilization.
You know, we spoke a bit earlier on what Muslims need to do to be better understood. What do you feel should maybe Americans do who are not Muslims? I mean, Muslim Americans, you said what they should do, for example. What should non-Muslim Americans, what do you feel, maybe what's the message, what do you think they should do in order to better understand the Muslims themselves? What do you think is the duty there?
Well, like I said, it has to be with education. I think I told you before that I am a fan of reading bumper stickers.
Okay.
And I every time I see a car with a bumper sticker, I just go behind it to read what it says. Sometimes
don't get too close, though.
Very captivating messages there.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite ones is the one that says, act locally and think globally.
Yeah.
As individuals, you know, most of us don't really have the ability of making, you know, all the global changes that are needed. But definitely in our own locality, we have that ability. So I would invite, you know, our American friends to read and educate themselves about Islam, simply because we are really impacted by this, by these people, by this religion, you know, we like it or not. But that is the
reality.
Case, you know. So for that, we ought to educate ourselves with regard to that religion, to the people who adhere to that religion. And I think that the books that you mentioned earlier, especially the one, The Straight Path by John Esposito, and this is a non-Muslim that happened to be very fair, you know, to the most part in that book, the quotes that you just read and you've been reading, especially the people who were arguing with Huntington,
yes,
with his Clash of Civilization, these are fair-minded people that have understood the religion for what it is. They chose to remain, you know, non-Muslims, and that is, you know, fine. But the idea is we can have our theological differences, yet that should not deter us from living peacefully together. And of all, you know, the most important thing would have to be the fact that ignorance breeds fear, and the only way to eliminate that fear is to educate ourselves about that, because that's unjustifiable fear that we are having. So I would urge them, be it they call their local Islamic center, they, you know, visit the mosques near them, get books, go into the internet, you know, watch programs like these. Mm-hmm. By all means, these are of great impact.
In fact, I have in my hand here the book Islam Today, A Short Introduction to the Muslim World. It won the award for the non-fiction book of the year, LA Times, non-fiction book of the year. This is the book by Professor Dr. Akbar Ahmed, Islam Today, A Short Introduction. This is the book that you have there, maybe shining there. In his conclusion of this book, which I want to read, he makes some suggestions regarding what needs to be done by Muslims and, you know, to understand one another and on both sides. Let me read, then you can maybe quote from there. He gives four or five suggestions, and maybe I think this is very good. He says in this section dealing with building bridges, and this is towards the concluding part of the book, the last segment of the book, the very last portion. He says building bridges. There are many steps that can be taken to help understanding between Islam and the West. The efforts need to come from both sides. First, the media need to take a more balanced and more understanding position. They need to resist the temptation to pass judgment, to slip into old-style Orientalist prejudices. They must also avoid the trap of using loaded words like fundamentalism, which cloud judgment and create prejudice. The Western media must look at Islam objectively, even with some empathy, and not respond to events in Muslim areas with constant aggression and hostility. It's also crucial that they should not impose their own intellectual framework on Islam. It's also necessary for the West to rid itself of the colonial and racial dimensions of its attitudes towards Islam. It is too easy to look at development projects, whether schools or roads, in Muslim countries and dismiss them as backward. It is well to remember that until a generation or two ago, most Muslim societies were ruled by European colonial powers, that many of these societies were deprived of the basic modern amenities. Most areas were without electricity, without roads, without drinking water. These are difficult hurdles, but they have to be cleared by Muslims. So it is imperative for the West to look on Muslims as equals on their own terms, not look down on them as some inferior species. This is the first point. Second, more Muslims need to be visible in the Western media, in films, on discussion programs, on the radio, and so on. It will allow Muslims to project their point of view as well as to counter their exotic and alien image. As the West dominates the world media, the initiative must come from it. But nonetheless, the importance. Okay. Third, more conferences and seminars for the general public, not only for Muslims. One problem that we have with Muslim communities, there are many conferences and seminars for, you know, like it's titled Islam and Muslim, but it's mostly attended by Muslim people. But he says more conferences and seminars for the general public need to be organized to explain Islam, Islam in the West. Fourthly, a basic knowledge of Islam could be taught in Western schools, so that the children do not grow up in ignorance of it. Ignorance breeds fear, and fear breeds prejudice and hatred. The fifth point he brings up, the major problems that causes so much anger and distress amongst Muslims need to be addressed. The Bosnians, the Kosovans in Europe, the Palestinians in the Middle East, Kashmiris in South Asia, for example. The routine beatings and torture and killings must stop. Life has become hell for many Muslims on earth. And the West must illustrate to the Muslims that justice will be done in these cases, and that the United Nations does not act only to hammer the enemies of the West. In turn, Muslims must convince the world that the media images of Islam as law-breaking and violent people are not true. These are the five points that, you know, he brings up. The first one is the idea of, the first one is the issue of the media. Mm-hmm. Second one is the idea of the more visibility of the Muslims. Mm-hmm. Third one, the idea of seminars and conferences held by Muslims, convened by Muslims, but also for Islam in the West. Very often the conference about Islam amongst Muslims. And fourthly, Islam could be taught in schools. you know, as you mentioned, go visit the Islamic centers and so on. And finally, the idea that the major issues need to be addressed. The West should see itself, speaking of human rights, as bastions of human rights. But when it goes to Europe, to the Middle East, it mustn't be bastions of its own economic interests, but of human rights as a whole, irrespective of whether it be for Muslims or against them, but be bastions of human rights on principle. Could you kind of comment on some of the points?
I think the first point that he started was with regard to the media. No one can really, you know, deny the influence and the impact that media has on us, be it the written, mass media, whatever it is. And unfortunately, many people shape their thoughts, or the media shape their thoughts, by presenting them, you know, whatever it is that they want to present to them. And lately, like I said earlier, every time something bad happens and the perpetrator happens to be Muslim, you would see the name Islam and that person equated and the act. Muslim terrorist, Muslim extremist, Muslim militants.
Today they caught a person doing pipe bombing all over the show, you know, and so on and so forth. His website is called dirtyjew.com. He's most likely a Christian person, Caucasian, for example, a white person. Doesn't make a difference. He did a criminal act. But you don't say he's a Christian fundamentalist or a Jewish fundamentalist or a white fundamentalist or whatever it may be, for example. And if anyone does it, it's wrong to do so. And that's the difficulty part. The Muslims very, very often face, you are almost guilty by association.
Exactly.
And this is a big problem that, you know, that we have to overcome.
And like you said, you know, you gave this example. Protestants and Catholics, they've been killing one another for a long time. In Ireland, the IRA. Mm-hmm. No one refers to them as Catholic terrorists or a Protestant terrorist. Do you know that these people are acting on their own merit, and there is no need for you to associate their behavior or their act with that religion that they claim to adhere to?
Yes.
Similarly, I think it's very fair that for Muslims to ask for the same thing.
Of course.
And that is, do not judge 1.4 billion people on the deeds of the few.
Yeah.
And I think at this point, the most damaging happens to be the media, unfortunately. Yeah. And that is why, you know, it must be the responsibility of the individual, that the individual takes it upon themselves that they want to learn about this, and I would go to them people to teach me about it. I think an excellent point that he made also with regard to Muslims going out. This is a two-way, you know, road. We cannot expect others to come to us, but we must also be willing to go to others as well. And unfortunately, most of our activities have been limited to the Muslims, conferences for the Muslims, workshops for the Muslims. And I think it is part of the contribution that we make, and that is by not depriving people of what we think is the final revelation from God, you know, to mankind, that would bring justice and happiness and, you know. And
which they are free to accept or reject.
Exactly. But at least our job is to convey and share that message with them. Another point that I also like is the fact that how the West sees Muslims. Mm-hmm. It's very with a superiority there. You know, there is some sort of prejudice involved into it, and that I believe can also take away.
And an overgeneralization. You know, they hate us. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's almost a taken for granted. It's axiomatic. They hate us. I mean, I'm from Africa, by the way. A lot of people in Africa don't love the policy of this country. But I never come across a person who said, I hate Americans, or hate. They may hate the policy. And there are many people, not only in the Middle East, by the way, the Far East, China, Africa. You go to a bunch of China, they hate the policies of what foreign policy, by the way. But that doesn't mean hating the people. But the point is that it's used as a political tool and as a means of motivating people. And they hate us, so well, we should hate them too. Yep. But they don't hate us.
And the resentment, like you said, is almost universal.
Yes.
Be it in China, Panama, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, Argentina, name it. And it's funny you mentioned this, because the other day I was doing research on terrorism, and this is an official definition of what terrorism is. It said that terrorism is a threat to the Western civilization. And I looked at it, and I don't mean to, you know, insult the intelligence of the viewers here, but I felt insulted. I said, wait a minute, if it's terrorism, why would it be a threat to the Western civilization only? It should be a threat to humanity.
Yes.
But yet, I think what I gather from it is that anything that is not approved of by the West, regardless of what it is, happens to be a threat against the Western civilization. And I think that is extremely arrogant.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And it should not be, and it should not be accepted.
Even Huntington's theory, the major problem that I have with it, I mean, he's welcome to his view, the major same colonialist mentality, you know, this Western civilization, a whole bunch of white folks,
I find it very strange, you know, and many of them former colonial masters. I mean, you know, it just smacks of racism to me. I wasn't so upset and offended by the Islamic civilization being a threat. This is the whole premise, you know, and then separating Latin America from the West has been something else. This is just so racist, you know, still a maintenance of some part of the crusader mentality, and on the other hand, maintenance of this white supremacist somewhat you know, colonialist mentality, which is just, you know, which just reeks of so much arrogance and you know, just bigotry. You know,
it's interesting that when people speak of the Western culture or the Western civilization, I usually refer to it as the ever-changing Western culture.
Yes.
Because you cannot really define it of what it is. It changed almost, what, every 10 years? Yes. Maybe sometimes even less than that. Mm-hmm. Okay, wait a minute. What is the definition, and where does it stop, and where doesn't? And it's, like you said, it's extremely, extremely arrogant, and it has to stop where people can objectively see,
yes,
what others can, yes, can offer them.
The other point that he brings up, the idea of you know, addressing major issues. Very often, I mean, we're dealing with that somewhat. That, you know, that very often people see, you know, a Western, for example, in Bosnia and so on, whether it be Palestine or wherever it may be, it's always seen that, you know, we're looking at our own economic interest. We're friends with Saudi Arabia not because we care about them. We're friends with Kuwait not because we care about them. It's the oil. If they had no oil, we don't care about them. So how much of a bastion of human rights are we really? These are the kind of questions that people are very bothered about. One other thing that I would like to maybe to look at, the need to build bridges. You know, I think, you know, through this program, and I'm very grateful to the Cal State Domingo Hills University for this 13 sessions that we had. I think it was from the community. We had, I think, tremendous response. But the idea that, you know, that people need to know themselves, to know their history, to know the history of other people, to appreciate one another. And there's a need, just not just to build bridges, to tolerate one another, but to really appreciate one another. What do you say about that?
You know, you can never emphasize this point enough. And that is, especially nowadays, the way the world is, by all means, we need to learn more about one another. Building bridges will prevent further devastation. Many times, most of the problems that are taking place could have been prevented had the bridge being built before. Mm-hmm. You know, like, to give you a few examples here in the States, when what took place on September the 11th took place, of many of the Muslim communities that had built the bridge between them and the non-Muslim communities, the backlashes were very, very, you know, insignificant, and they were very small.
Yes.
Now, the communities where they did not do this, you see that the backlash was really, really great. Mm-hmm. So we can see that it is, you know, some sort of a preventative method as well. And I'm not only talking about Muslims and non-Muslims. Generally speaking,
yes, yes,
human beings, we ought to come, you know, to this understanding that we need to build the bridge and appreciate one another for just being a human race.
I cannot agree with you any more than that. I think, don't think anybody can disagree with that. We have come to the end of 13 sessions of this program on Islamic culture and civilization of the SBS 318 course. My dear friend and brother, Sheikh Yasir Fazaga, the Imam of the Orange County Islamic Foundation. He was here on the first program, and I think we're in between also, and then for the last one as well, my first guest and my last guest. And we have come, I think, a long way. We've gone through the whole history of Islam, from Mecca through Africa, through Europe, and finally to America, and then Islam in the West. We've looked at various things, Islam's contribution to civilization. We looked at the Quran, does it promote religious violence, the Quran and violence, for example. We dealt with the whole issue of the prophetic personality's contribution. We dealt with the fundamentals of the faith of Islam and how it relates to the Judeo-Christian tradition, how Muslims see it as a continuation of the Abrahamic tradition and a culmination of the tradition, in fact. We also looked at various architecture and contribution of Islam. We looked at the mosque. We visited the mosque locally and shown how mosques and Islamic centers of learning were intertwined throughout the history. And also, of course, we looked at Islam's contribution to civilization as a whole. In the initial part, we also dealt with why study an ideology other than your own. And this is very important. I always tell my students in the class here at Cal State Domingo Hills that we have studied Islam now, but use this understanding and this knowledge to study other civilizations, to study others, to understand others better as well. If you have learned to appreciate Islam and Islamic civilization, now use the same thing to appreciate other civilizations and other cultures. Consider ourselves as part of a larger global family with a different variety and different tastes, but nonetheless of one human family. Archives of this entire series can be accessed anytime and viewed on the internet by visiting islammasjid.com. That's www.islammasjid.com that you have there. And also I wish to thank all the contributors, all the many phone calls, all the messages of support that we've received from the community online, on the phone, through islammasjid.com. There are numerous people from all over the world who have written and thanked us for what we have done here. At Casa Domingo Hills, I wish to thank the Dean for the Social Behavioral Science Department, Williams, Selassie Williams, for granting the opportunity, Dr. Warren Ashley, and then of course here, the control rooms, people with the back, who you don't see, we've been doing all the works and doing a tremendous amount of work, Brian at the back, Sean, Andre, Wendy Anson, and of course the person from whom I've learned so much and become so close to love, Van Bridgman, who has been a tremendous source of inspiration and assistance and has polished me up somewhat from the first program to this one. I think I could go on to ABC or NBC right now, man. Ted Koppel, watch out. So thank you very much for being with us, and we say farewell to you, may peace be unto you, and I hope through this program that at least I've been able to reach to you and you have been able to understand Islam better. Peace be unto you, as you say, assalamu alaikum. May God be with you. May His peace and mercy and blessing be upon you, and all the best.